You are listening to a special edition Hard Traveling Fanboys Avengers Endgame spoiler filled review.
Welcome, Place to Be Nation, to a very special edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are gathered here in the L-shaped studio, Vancouver. You know all the rest of the gimmick. And we are here to offer you our review of the biggest movie in the country right now, in the world, in the universe, possibly. I can't say that for sure. Highlander Endgame. That's right. As a panelist here brought up during before our show, we're going to be talking about one of the great Highlander movies, one of the certainly a Highlander movie that happened. No, we're actually here to talk about the other Endgame, Avengers Endgame, the number one movie in the world, breaking all kinds of box office records. We saw it over the weekend, and we are here to offer you our unabashed thoughts on this film as part of Avengers Month right here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. But we're not doing it alone, as I referenced a moment ago. We are being joined by a panel of experts and fans here at Place to Be Nation. And, well, I guess before I introduce them, I should introduce my partner, the Brooks to my Dunn? I don't know.
Still not entirely sure whether that's a compliment or not. Which one was better?
Dunn was, I don't know. That's very subjective. I mean, we can agree that both of them were legendary legends in their yes. time. But Nick, how are you on this fine nondescript evening?
Oh, I'm okay. I had to cut grass earlier, so my balls are nice and lathered up and sweaty, which makes for the same recording conditions as any other week of HTF.
And that's horrifying. All right, so the first guest that I want to introduce this week is a man known far and wide as the Ivory Maw. He is the co-host of Talkin' Pop, the co-host of Talkin' WCW, frequent appearances on Conversation Comics. He is a man about town. Ladies and gentlemen, the legend himself, Tim Capel. Tim, welcome back to the Hard Traveling Studios.
The Ivory Maw. I think I'll take it. I like that. And you know what else I like, Greg? I like you blowing past your own gimmick. You know, the whole from the L-shaped, oh, the hell with it, is what I was thinking with that fine introduction. So, thank you for the laughs. Thank you for having me on. And yeah, we've got a lot to get into here.
We do. And not to be outdone is Tim's frequent co-host on Talkin' Pop, Talkin' WCW. She is also the leader of Freak Out Drive. I don't know why I refer to you as the leader of that. That's a very odd terminology to use. But nonetheless, the leader of the Freak Out Drive-In. She is none other than Jennifer Smith. Jennifer, how are you doing on this undisclosed evening?
My balls are all... also nice and lathered, so I'm ready to go.
That's interesting information to learn. So
just saying.
These are revelations right here. Right.
Greg almost went into flare giggle there.
That's what Wahoo told me with that. But unfortunately, Wahoo could not be with us as he's been dead for 20 years. But even better than Wahoo.
I never knew that.
Jesus, Rick. You have good news.
He reached out to a man that has only been on our show through the joys of Watchmen comic book theater, whatever you want to call our project that we do on occasion. But he is the co-host of 90 to Nothing, a new podcast here, looking at all the great films of the 1990s. He hosts that alongside Russell Sellers. He is my good friend for, God, the better part of two decades now, Mr. Sam Neely. Welcome to the show.
Well, my balls are fine because I'm wearing some baggy shorts and have the fan on.
Hot.
Well, Sam, we are gathered together here today to talk about this pop culture event, this pop culture sensation, Avengers Endgame. Obviously, this is not going to be a watch-along review for you folks, the listening audience, as the movie is still in theaters. But what we're going to do here is we're going to jettison our usual Hard Travelers for Hire format where we review the film as we watch it, and then we, at the end, give our Marvel rankings. The reason for that is because later this month, we're going to have an all-star panel of prior Hard Travelers for Hire guests that will be offering our MCU rankings, and before then, we will be collecting you, the listening audience's rankings of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. This should give you plenty of time to watch Endgame and put it in your pantheon, and then we will bring those rankings to you at the end of this month in a special giant size edition. So for this purpose, we are strictly talking about Endgame and how we reacted to it. But first, we're going to go around the panel here, and I want to start with you, Sam, because you're never on our show. So I wanted to get your kind of experience with the MCU and tell the folks kind of how you have come into the MCU. Did you come in late? Were you in on the ground floor? I mean, I know the answers to this, obviously, but the audience doesn't.
I was in before the ground floor. I remember reading an article in the newspaper. This is how long ago it was about how, you know, Marvel movies were going to finally start being made, that they were selling the rights to the Hulk and X-Men and Spider-Man, and all these movies are going to be made. This is, you know, back in the 90s. And they're saying, and my big, what they were talking about in these articles was CGI is finally to the level, which, you know, CGI is definitely the best thing about Ghost Rider and whatnot. But my first thought was, oh my God, this is great, because all these movies are going to come out and then there's going to be a crossover. And I remember, I think I said something to my mom, and my mom just kind of scoffed and said, no, that would be too expensive of a movie to make. Nobody would ever do that. And then that was just kind of my thoughts on it until after, you know, I went and saw Iron Man in the theater, and somebody had told me, stay through the credits. I stayed through the credits. And, you know, this was 10 years later at this point, but I was like, oh my God, they're finally doing it. They're finally doing it. And then I saw Incredible Hulk like later that summer. And so in 2012, I was living in Huntsville at the time, and I actually bought tickets to drive to Nashville because it was the nearest IMAX theater to finally see Avengers. And my coworkers were asking me, why are you so excited? And I was like, because this is the movie that I was waiting for when I was 16. Like, this is the movie I've been waiting for since then. So that was kind of, and since then, it's also been, even the weaker MCU films, I don't care. I've seen most of them in theaters. There were a few times when I didn't have a car or was unemployed, so I couldn't go to the movies. But for the most part, I'm lately just been there opening night every night.
That, I think that's an experience that a lot of us can relate to. If we were fans as a kid, kind of growing up, thinking of a movie like The Avengers, a movie like Avengers Endgame in particular. I've told the story on this podcast many times of reading the Infinity Gauntlet when I was, I guess, 7 or 8 years old, and just loving it and thinking to myself, gosh, I would give anything to see a cartoon or a movie of this book, and never thinking it would be possible, you know, in my wildest dreams. And to see with Infinity War and now with Endgame, to see Thanos brought to the big screen, and to see this story that I loved as a kid adapted and changed and, you know, even improved in some ways. And it was an experience for sure. Now, for the rest of the panelists here, Nick and I have kind of talked about our experiences with the MCU because we've been reviewing every movie. Jenny and Tim, we've had you on before, but just kind of give us your headspace going in to Avengers Endgame. Let's start with Tim on this one, because I know you kind of came in to Endgame in a little bit of a different headspace than maybe the rest of us did.
Yeah, if you're looking for the prequel to this podcast, go back in the archives about a year and listen to mine and Jenny and Tim's Infinity War extravaganza. That was the length of which I believe there is an alternate universe where that podcast is still going on a year later.
Yes. Much like WrestleMania 32, yes.
There you go.
And still isn't as long as an episode of Between the Sheets.
Whoa. So the last time I talked about one of these movies, it was on a podcast that ended up being longer than the movie, as Nick alluded to. And here we have a movie that is even longer than that. So I'm going to try to keep it contained here, but suffice to say, I wasn't the biggest fan in the world of Infinity War for reasons that we don't really need to rehash unless you'd really like me to. Going into this, like, I would say, like, it did sort of take a little bit of the enthusiasm that I had for this series right out of me. Did it come back? In a way, yes. I think that in the sense that this was a genuine, like, cultural moment that I really just wanted to be in on the ground floor for and be a part of the conversation. And coupled with the curiosity of just how is it going to end? I know it's going to end, and I'm kind of ready for it. And I'm like, yeah, bring it on. So I had that anticipation and kind of that rush, just like a jolt of adrenaline right through me about, I would say, in that 2-week period before Endgame premiered. So it did kind of come back. Going in, I don't know if I was thinking I would like the movie, if that makes sense, but still looking forward to seeing it. So we'll see how that ultimately panned out.
Absolutely. And very, very interesting. Now, Jenny, what was your thought process going into Endgame? What was your headspace? Were you like freaking out that this was, that you were going to see this, or were you kind of like, you know, kind of ho-hum about it? What was your kind of anticipation level for this one?
Okay, so I was freaking out about it, and I came from a place of complete and total fear, which ended up being completely true. And like we'll discuss, as soon as I got to a certain point in the movie, I knew that my deepest fears were going to happen. So then it was just like delighted dread the rest of the other 2 hours of the movie. And then that event happened, and then I died. The end.
You died, and then we're reborn.
This is the ghost of Jenny you're speaking to from the other side of Endgame.
Now, Nick, on our standpoint, I guess we should talk about how we approached the film going in. I was of course super stoked for this. Yes. beyond words. We've talked about my love of Infinity War, mm-hmm. In particular, due to numerous factors, nostalgia and such. But like, I think I was almost like kind of like it wouldn't have mattered what they did with this one because I was so pleased with the last one. But as we got closer and the reviews started rolling in, I didn't read any of them. I had deliberately tried to avoid trailers. Deliberately tried to avoid reviews and stuff like that. But when I saw the tomato score and the some of the excerpts that were leaking online from critics, I was like, well, you know, okay, all right, they got me now. Now I'm like, now my hype level's from like a 9 out of 10 to like a 28 out of 10. You might even say it was a 5.5 store excitement level, star rather. And
what a poor tastemaker you are, Greg.
Nick, where were you at on the excitement level for this one going in?
Oh man, I'm trying to recall a movie I've been as excited about this to see in theaters for. Let's see, Infinity War would probably be up there just because we at the time didn't really know the narrative structure that was going to take. I think we all had some guesses at it, and we knew we were going to see things we had been building to at that point for the better part of 10 years. So that would be up there. Obviously, The Dark Knight Rises and The Dark Knight, my two previous favorite films of all time.
Those types.
I don't want to. We'll have that discussion at a later date. It's too soon. God, Tim, don't get me off track here. One thing that was a little bit different this time around, Greg, is like we've discussed this before. I am not pro spoiler, but I'm not typically this paranoid about avoiding them as I was for this film. When the Russos were kind of coming out in interviews and saying you don't want to know anything about this movie, and we had been led to believe that what was being shown in the trailers was primarily only from the first like 40 minutes of the movie, and this movie had all kinds of secrets and twists and turns that we weren't going to see coming, I started to kind of intentionally distance myself, much the way that you did.
Yes. Even Vince Russo actually tweeted out, "Do not spoil it for yourself, bro."
There you go. So I didn't avoid the theatrical trailers the way you did, but I did avoid TV spots. I read a couple of reviews that were spoiler free, and yet somehow by the time I got in there, I had two things spoiled for me before we ever walked into the theater, despite my best effort. So I'm sure we'll talk about those as we go forward. And this is probably a good time to mention, while we're on the topic of spoilers, if you haven't seen this movie, turn the podcast off now.
Yes.
And I say that even if you are someone who insists that spoilers don't bother you and that you can enjoy something despite spoilers, I genuinely believe you will enjoy this movie more if you don't know where it's going the entire yes. time. So
don't listen to this podcast. Stop it now. Burn the podcast if you can find a way to burn it. And then come back and it'll be available in some archive somewhere. So listen to us then, but only after you've seen the movie. So spoiler alert across the board. Mm. Let's just dive right in, guys. This movie, of course, picks up after the ending of Infinity War. Thanos snaps. Half of life is wiped out in the known cosmos. And our heroes that are left are in tatters. They're spiritually, emotionally broken. The world is spiritually, emotionally broken. And basically, all the bad things in life are happening to them, and they're not happy about, you know, all the things that have happened, and they're intent on getting their revenge on Thanos and fixing things, but damn it, it just doesn't work. So this whole movie, in many ways, is it's peaks and valleys, right? It's where we start at the low point, we go to a high point, we get to another low point, we go to another high point. The heroes are really run through the ringer here, but with the idea of that word Avengers, avenging things and coming back and getting their moment along the way. So let's just kind of attack this broadly. I don't even know how to structure this. I've only seen the movie once at this point, but I don't want to go plot point by plot point, but let's just get some general thoughts from the gang here. Who wants to start us off?
I'll raise my hand. I thought it was really interesting structurally. I mean, you talk about how do we even begin to discuss this film, and
right.
yeah. you don't want to go blow by blow, and I agree with that, but I think what I came away with was most of these movies, you have kind of those big action set pieces at sort of predictable intervals, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was not so with this movie. I mean, you, of course, have the major climactic final battle, which is pretty much everything that it's purported to be and lives up to in every way. But prior to that, yes, you do have action scenes, but you don't have those major, like, you're not going to walk out of this movie and go, okay, let's rank the action scenes now, you know, like you can
yeah.
with other films. I mean, there's that beat at the beginning when they go off to basically confront Thanos and turn
they chop
all
his head
back.
Off in the first
yeah,
chop the first,
his
like,
head
15
off.
Minutes of the
yeah,
movie.
You can't yeah. even say in the first act. It's like in the first 15 minutes, and you're like, "Whoa, okay, where do we go from here?"
And yeah, we had people audibly there was a guy like probably three rows behind me when I saw it on opening night that audibly said, "What the fuck are we gonna do for the next 2.5 hours?"
Right, so it's kind of like keeping that downbeat tone because you think this should be a big triumphant moment, but it's come too early in the film and it is perhaps for naught. So where are we going to go from here, leading to the kind of extended second act with the time travel? And there's some fun stuff in there, but it's not like you see, again, these major fight scenes, these big action set pieces. So I don't know, from that standpoint, I kind of admired it for how different it was, how much of a departure it felt like from other films in the series. I mean, necessarily so. It's, look at what we're starting with. Half of all life in the universe has been annihilated, and that's our status quo going in here.
And as cornball as it might sound, it's sort of an interesting lesson to teach right out of the gates in this movie, that the Avengers, they go and they avenge, right? They mm-hmm. get their moment with Thanos and they kill him, they murder him, and yet their moment of physical revenge, their violent revenge, doesn't actually solve anything.
Yeah.
Yep. Doesn't make any life any better for them. It just makes things worse. If anything, for Thor in particular, all it does is make him feel worse that he does do this, and it just reminds him of his ultimate failure. And so I think that's kind of a bold thing for a superhero movie to do right out of the gate, saying that, you know, we're conditioned to watch these movies and, okay, Batman's going to kick the Joker's ass now, or, oh, Superman's going to defeat – well, not Superman so much. He usually has to beat real estate schemes in movies. But, you know, like, I don't know. Some other hero is going to kick the villain's ass. In this movie, they do kick the villain's ass, and it means nothing. Mm-hmm. It has no impact on anything. So I really admired the movie kind of starting out that way.
It kind of shows what I saw in how Thor reacted and how they all react in the aftermath of killing Thanos, is that they were essentially being Avengers. They were getting this revenge, and it was anticlimactic, and it just mm-hmm. made them feel terrible. Whereas when you get to the end, when they're actually fighting to defend something, the fight has more weight, and the fight actually means something, and it's actually a victory. It's not a Pyrrhic victory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that may be the first time this year we've had Pyrrhic victory utilized on the show. So I applaud that as well.
I don't know how to spell it, so it's a good thing this is a podcast.
Jenny, what about you? What did you make of sort of the structure of the movie and throwing us into this immediate revenge situation?
Well, I think that we all sort of theorized that there was going to be a time jump. So I'm not going to say I expected it, but I wasn't super surprised by it, because we kind of knew that we were going to have – I mean, I wasn't expecting to see Thor cut his head off. Absolutely not. But I knew that there would be some major gap in time. And then I am a super sucker for time travel. So all of that whole part that Tim glossed over – time travel.
We're just getting started, dear.
Yeah. So that was just like completely delightful. And it kind of, so many parts of that act, like sort of made up for the sort of wah feeling you got after the, like, oh, he's dead, but it doesn't matter. So it kind of made up for it.
One moment that we have to talk about early in the film so full disclosure to the listening audience, we've had a spoiler thread going on Facebook Messenger for a few days now with a bunch of our groups of friends that have seen the movie.
You will not be allowed in if you ask.
No.
As a listener.
damn.
Well.
But yes, that's true. The moment that kind of a lot of us mentioned in that group was the delay of the announcement of the time jump, right? So we get back to Earth, and then we see 5, and then it's there's a beat, and then years later, we jump forward 5 years after this big climactic moment with Thanos. What did you guys make of that? And Nick, you can feel free to chime in as well. That was such a like depressing moment in a movie, but also that giving it that emotional weight, giving it that, you know, you talk a lot, Nick, about stakes in movies. Yes. And this is seeing the ultimate ramifications of what if the good guys lose? Mm-hmm. And, I thought it was an amazing choice to make for them to jump 5 years in the future.
Yes, I would completely agree. You know, Jenny just said that by the time we reach the time travel portion of the film, she feels like it was making up for the prior part of the film. I've seen it twice at this point. The second time I saw it, I went with my wife and a big group of people, of course. And about an hour and 10 minutes I look over at her, and she looks miserable. And I whisper to her, I'm like, "Are you okay?" And she's like, "I fucking hate this." And I'm like, you know, but she meant it in the same way I think that Jenny meant it, in that like it's making you feel so miserable. Yeah. And
it's putting you in the positions of these characters.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And we have discussed on this show numerous times before how there is nothing I love more in superhero media than being made to feel miserable. Like,
yes, take an almost sexual pleasure out of watching heroes.
I am sadistic. I have said that before. I have no qualms with it. I want to see our heroes brutally beaten and emotionally tortured as often as possible.
You would like to, you're the kind of guy that would like to see another respected veteran in your industry be betrayed by his best friend. You'd come out on the stage and you'd tell him that he was taking it easy on him and to open him up.
And to open him up. That's right. Because to me, like, as much as I love seeing our heroes triumph, I love seeing them triumph even more when they've been dragged down to their absolute low point, when it looks like things can't get any worse and yet they somehow possibly do, and yet they retain the essence of what makes these characters great.
Agreed.
It's a criticism I've had at times in the MCU where I feel like they go too often for the joke at the expense of emotional weight and stakes, as you said. Thor Ragnarok obviously being the most notable example that we've debated on this show of that. And here in this film, I loved so much that they didn't do that. Yes, there was humor. I'm not saying I've never said once you can't have humor at all. There was humor at times in this movie, but you got the impression that each of these characters felt this loss and were having to own this loss. And the 5 years thing is just a wonderful, wonderful mechanism to help to illustrate how far these characters have fallen. I mean, when we catch up with Black Widow after the time jump, you can see that her confidence, which has never been shaken in the entire MCU, is virtually non-existent. Captain America is trying to give the traditional, you know, motivational Captain America speech, and you can tell his heart isn't in it.
Mm-hmm. He's going to grief counseling, and he's basically lying through his teeth to these people because he later admits that he himself has not gotten over what happened.
Right.
Thor, of course.
Yes,
Fat Thor.
Thor is a character who has been driven by confidence and ego and pride so much in these movies, and he has completely let himself go.
His ego was destroyed.
Yes, his ego and confidence were destroyed by the events of this movie, and I'm assuming you could make the argument that Ragnarok as well, being immediately before it. He has lost everything, and finally, he is being allowed to feel that loss, which was a big thank you from this Thor fan to the Russos, who I wish would make Thor movies from now on instead of Taika Waititi.
Clint Barton has become a Punisher-like figure who... We have to talk about the opening of this film, the Hawkeye.
So that's one thing that I had spoiled for me, Greg, is that there was a review that purported to be spoiler-free, one of like three reviews I read. The Time review of this movie says in like the first four paragraphs that we open at Hawkeye's farm with his family being dusted.
Oh my god!
Spoiler free review. So I was like, oh god. I mean, like, we all assumed after we had seen the Ronin bit in the trailer that clearly something terrible had happened to Hawkeye, and we kind of guessed that his family had been dusted or whatever. But the second time I saw it, that's another thing we should probably track throughout this.
Time magazine can go to hell.
Is how many times each of us cried throughout the movie. But I was wet around the eyes like that, you know, pretty much in that opening scene because. Whereas I used to go to movies and be largely unaffected emotionally by most things, now if you put a dad and a daughter on screen and something happens, I turn into a fucking menopausal woman watching a Hallmark commercial. It's the most embarrassing fucking thing on the face of this planet. But the movie opens, and I turn to my wife, and I'm like, how many napkins do you have? And she's like, well, you've got all the napkins. I was like, here, you're going to want these. And I look over at her like 30 seconds later, and like the tears are already like just pouring. So it is an emotionally devastating start to this film, and one that – signaled to me that this shit was going to be for me, you know, right up my alley the entire time.
Because not only does he lose his daughter, he loses his entire family at once. Like everybody. Three daughters and a wife?
Two sons, a daughter, and a wife.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's about as impactful as you can get. And it certainly goes a long way to pretty much making him their version of the Punisher. He's lost everything, and now he's just taking it out on the world.
I thought that scene in particular did a lot to address one of the criticisms I had about Infinity War, which was I didn't really feel the impact of the snap and everyone getting dusted. I mean, it's in the thick of battle, and kind of the mechanism for how that was done was sort of, I don't know, it felt very, well, this is so blindingly obvious now that here's how we're going to bring everybody back. You know, like it just, I don't know. It landed with a real thud for me in a way that I think it didn't for a lot of other folks. And being able to see just the weight and the humanity of that decision in the opening minutes of this movie, it kind of set the tone that you were in for a very different experience. So they kind of had my attention from the jump. And that was the first of like three gasps in that first probably 20-minute stretch, the other being Thanos being decapitated, and the third being that five-year jump. I think we're critical of time jumps and a lot of the media that we consume, rightly so. Looking at you, The Walking Dead, just in the way that it's kind of used as a get out of jail free card, right?
Yep.
And here it's anything but. It's to really, again, just sell you on the gravity of this. They throw that five up there, right? And then there's that beat before you see years later. And it's just like, they could have said five fucking years later. I think everyone would have went, yep, they really did that. And we see this, and this gets to another point about Infinity War. I, you know, kind of looked at Thanos and thought, well, his motivation sort of sucks here. And it seems like somebody should be calling him out on just his bullshit, which didn't really happen to a great extent in Infinity War. Well, here, no one's saying it, but they're showing it. They're showing us that, no, Thanos, you did not make things better. This is like almost an apocalyptic wasteland now that's been created. And all anyone can do is basically cry and hug each other and talk about how depressed they are. I mean, that's really what this would look like. So,
you know what? I think things would have been okay if they had a Rick Grimes to lead them through this situation.
Yes, if only. So, but we do have a Captain America. So
yes,
he's leading these grief counseling sessions, which aren't populated by a lot of people. It does bring us two pretty cool cameos, though. We get which Russo was that who tells the story of trying to date after his husband's significant other was dusted. We also saw in that kind of group shot real quick, Jim Starlin. So
yes, which I didn't realize until the chat group actually, Tim, because I have never known what Jim Starlin looks like.
So. Yeah. I'd seen pictures of him before, but it didn't register until it was like, hey, did you catch this cameo? And I was like, oh yeah, that's who that guy was. So,
but that's very cool for him, because I know I read an interview with Starlin today actually, where he was talking about just kind of like how emotional it is for him that, you know, this sort of concept that he came out with for a niche comic book back in the 70s has now become this pop culture icon, and you know, that something as simple as Thanos snapping his fingers is now, you know, ingrained in our culture, that, you know, it felt like this unexpected career achievement award of sorts. So that it was cool for him to get a chance to be in the movie.
Yeah.
For sure. But yeah, the whole way that this movie rewards the fans of the franchise, not just the Avengers franchise, but all the sub franchises underneath that banner, is incredible. Whether you're a fan of the Guardians of the Galaxy, whether you're a fan of the Iron Man franchise, the Captain America franchise, of course, whatever character is your favorite, truly every character got a moment in this movie. And we're going to talk about that as we go along. For sure. But I wanted to talk about Hawkeye for a moment, because he's a character that I think you could make a very strong argument has been underserved in the MCU. He had very little to do outside of, you know, he was in the first Avengers movie, of course, and he was mind controlled for much of it. And then in Age of Ultron, they gave him the family subplot. But really, we haven't had a chance to really get to know and connect with Clint Barton much. And I thought this movie did a lot to remedy that, did a lot to remedy the problem of having Hawkeye feel like an essential member of the Avengers. Because let's face it, if we could drop anyone from the team, I think all of us would have dropped Hawkeye going into this movie. But the the way that Renner plays him in this movie, the emotional beats they give him, the transformation into Ronin and him coming back for one chance at redemption, one chance to bring his family back and to undo the damage that was done, and one chance to be a hero again. I thought they really gave him, among many other characters, they gave him sort of an arc that was redemptive for his character, but also on a metatextual level, redemptive in terms of a guy that they probably should have found more to do with along the years. And what did you guys make of that? Agree or disagree?
No, I would agree with that, but I will admit that I did use the Ronin scene to go to the bathroom because I was like, okay, I can kind of get through if I kind of miss this little part. So, but yeah, that scene with him on the cliff top, you know, with Nat was just, it kind of made everything else sort of worth it at that point. I'd never expected to be that and that place with him, you know, and him wanting to trade places with her so badly, mm-hmm. and wanting to, knowing the things that he had done and needing to be able to make up for it. It was unexpected on my part.
I actually have something I wonder about that scene is, did Nebula know that that's what's required to, like, she knew that Thanos went away, Gamora was gone, and he had the Soul Stone, but when she sent two best friends to Vormir, mm-hmm. did she know that that was going to be required and not tell
like
them?
She did.
Because that's why she chose those two?
I would think so.
Yeah, I picked up that. But
yeah, because if you had sent anybody else, like, I guess maybe you could have sent Tony and Rhodey. That would have been the only other option, really, that would have fulfilled the requirement.
But in Nebula's mind, she's probably thinking, who do we... who do we need the most if shit really goes sideways here? Like, who's going to contribute the most tactically? Probably not Black Widow and the guy with the sword, but they do have a relationship. So let's go have one of them, you know, not come back from this.
I even said that to the girl that I went to the movie with. I'm like, why they send the two, like, humans, you know, to the death planet? With death itself, that was like,
I think that makes sense, and you would think to yourself, gosh, what a bitch move by Nebula, but not really.
She's a strategist.
I'd never thought of that strategically. I love that interpretation.
The scene before I get to that, though, I just want to speak out in defense of the Ronin scene, because you guys know my genre interest.
Oh, it was awesome.
There ain't no way I'm skipping out on a sword fight in Japan. So,
right. Yeah, I had to be strategic with those bathroom breaks. So.
Yes.
Now, granted,
my first viewing without a break. I was kind of proud.
I did too. Yeah.
Me too.
I had one break my second viewing and none my first time.
Now, granted, I paid for it because the drink that I got tasted like complete doo-doo shit, to quote our friend Tim, by the time the movie ended. So I went over to take my sip, and I was like, well, finally, I reward myself. And I took a sip, and, well, not good.
Same exact experience, Greg, because, like, you know, you try to make the right choice and get, like, the Coke Zero. And Coke Zero, it tastes fine when it's cold, but warm Coke Zero is just the worst thing on the face of the planet. It was awful.
It tastes like someone took a crap
or a dump in your cup.
That wasn't good. But other than that, I managed to make it through without a break as well, because I didn't drink anything. The Avengers 10 did not have as much popcorn in it as we expected. So that didn't play a factor either. So,
I ran to the bathroom when Nat and Clint get to Vormir finally, and Vormir pops up on the screen. Like, I knew they were going to be climbing the mountain for a little bit and then talking to the Red Skull, and then I could probably run to the bathroom, piss, and be back before the fight, you know, the little battle between the two of them on top of the cliff started. And yes, that's exactly what happened. I came back, like, as they were discussing who was going to go over. So that, I felt like that was a well-timed bathroom break on my part.
Yeah, the arc for Hawkeye was so great, because in that moment, and I can't remember who pointed it out to me, or that is the inverse of how Thanos handled that exact same situation.
Yeah.
Right? Thanos... Okay, yes, he was very sad by throwing Gamora in there, but was he really, though? I mean, like, for Thanos, he was sad, but it was like, to him, there was no choice. It was, yes, obviously I'm going to throw it. These are two heroes who are literally fighting each other to be the ones that sacrifice themselves, not out of some selfish heroic fantasy, but because that's how much they care about the other person, that they are not willing to let them be the one to die. And I thought that was just fantastic for both characters, which I would make the argument that both characters have been underused in the MCU, and both finally got a chance to shine with big heroic moments here. Huge arc for both of these characters, because Nat is another character that I've been very public on this show about saying they should have done a Black Widow movie years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of embarrassing that they didn't. But they are writing it with one next year, and I thought in this movie, her journey was so – to see how broken she is at the beginning and to see her go out on top and to see her and her and Clint kind of battle each other to get that moment, and then for her to get that heroic moment – the movie did a lot to redeem so many characters, and I'm going to talk about another one in a little bit. But yeah, so what were your guys' thoughts on Nat and Clint in this movie, and in particular that scene on Vormir that we seem to be going back to? Because I know, Nick, you said that – or actually Danielle told us both that that scene was the one that broke her more than any other.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of – I was trying to look at the movie from like a, you know – from a self-contained storytelling standpoint. So when they open the movie with Clint and his family, and you kind of know that he's on this journey to get his family back, once they get to Vormir and knowing what I knew about the way that was going to work from Infinity War, I was like, Nat's going over the edge of this cliff. I couldn't see any other way they would open the movie with Hawkeye losing his family if they weren't going to give you that reunion by the end. So I thought it was a good little fight scene, but I guess I wasn't as on the edge of my seat even the first time I saw it as maybe you guys were, because I was just kind of expecting it to be Nat from the jump.
And see, I thought they might do the angle of Clint dying is how he gets his reunion, you know, where he's like, I get to,
well, it would be very
family.
Short in that case.
yeah they're brought back at the end without a,
well, picture. Assuming they all ended up in the same place.
We get a shot of them in heaven. Clint's reunited with them, and then they get dusted away from heaven back to Earth.
Looking up at them. Yes.
Do they go? Well, I mean, do they go to the traditional afterlife, or do they actually go into the Soul Stone? Because
yeah,
Gamora was
because,
in the Soul Stone.
Yeah, and then later on, Peter references that he and Doctor Strange have been talking to each other just moments before, and they, you know, so there's somewhere where all these people.
And that was interesting because we got a glimpse of what I assume was the Soul World at the end of Infinity War with Thanos talking to Child Gamora.
Yeah, because it was orange, which is the color of the Soul Stone.
Right, and at no point do we see that in Endgame, which was kind of interesting.
Well, in Endgame, they came from where they were, and so I the impression I got from what Peter was saying was that he woke up back on the planet.
Right, that's strong. Right, yeah. That's how I interpreted
what
it as well.
What if you were in an airplane when you got dusted?
Well, that's my – because
are
somebody
people,
was
like, raining
because that
from
helicopter – in the post-credit scene of Infinity War, that helicopter crashed into the building. Did the pilot reappear in the middle of the sky?
That's right. Yeah, are people like raining from the skies now?
Yes, my headcanon. Yes, exactly.
Did anybody read the?
If you're driving, I mean, shit.
Tim, you might be the only one. I mean, Nick, you might have read. I can't remember. Did any of you read the comic book 52, DC comic?
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit.
There's a scene. So one of the subplots in there is that Lex Luthor creates this drug that can give people superpowers. Mm-hmm. So all these people, of course, over the course of several months show up to get these superpowers, and almost everybody wants flight. So randomly,
he
hits the button to turn off the powers, and all these people just fall to their death.
They just plummet, yeah.
Oh,
that's exactly how that happened.
I forgot about that. I had
pictured Endgame the same thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right? You kind of have to. I had a terrible thought after Nat made the sacrifice that I don't think is really being intellectually honest, but it was the first thing that popped into my head, which was, gosh, these movies kind of like throwing women off of cliffs. And then I was like, let's not do that. Let's not go there just this once, you know, because
call it cliffing instead of frigging.
Yeah, and I have to be honest, I don't really think that's what this was.
No.
I think a lot of that is just, I wish it had been him and not her. You know, like I get it. Thematically, that's really the end of her story. Like, this is what her story is leading to. She's as much as we hear about, oh, the red in my ledger, I have to square things, I have to make things right. She, you know.
Yeah, but he has spent the last 5 years indiscriminately murdering. I would not have been sad if it had been him.
How much red is in his ledger?
Come on.
So, yeah, I mean, I get what they're going for, and I do think they earned it. I don't know. There's a part of me that just thinks anyone that complains about the lack of Hawkeye's utilization in these movies, in movies that feature Thor, the Hulk, Iron Man, and Captain America, can kind of go straight to hell. These movies have done Perish forbid, but these movies have done fine by him. Shut the fuck up.
Tim with the hottest of takes.
I mean, really, though, you're going to complain, oh, Hawkeye didn't get it. Come on.
I was more concerned about Black Widow's lack of utilization, for the record.
Yeah, yeah. No, that wasn't directed at you, and I knew you were referring more to her than him. You just felt like you had to say it.
Nick actually used Hawkeye as a counter to me earlier today when I said that Black Widow was underutilized in the MCU. He said, look at Hawkeye. And I was like, well.
That was yesterday.
No, that was today. No, it was yesterday, yeah. We didn't do the time on it.
I also don't love this version of Hawkeye where he's, you know, kind of the company man, kind of the family man. Doesn't really feel as much like Hawkeye as the other characters really do feel like they capture their comic counterparts. So there's some of that in there too. Because I love comics Hawkeye, don't get me wrong.
I kind of saw a lot of similarities to how his personality took it in House of M when he realized that, I guess, he was dead in the other reality, and he kind of goes crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that he becomes Ronan in this film was the same kind of thing. It's like he's got nothing left to live for, and so he just kind of goes crazy.
Did borrow a page from that.
So switching gears into another character that I want to talk about here is Nebula, which is a character I never would have imagined 5 years ago that we would be talking about in any kind of extensive manner, because she's kind of introduced in Guardians of the Galaxy as this, you know, not that terribly interesting character, the first movie. And they improved her a lot, of course, in the second Guardians movie and started adding some depth to her character. And then of course in Infinity War she plays a role as well. But I thought she was really one of the stars of this movie, and another character that was kind of under the radar. That when you look at this character Nebula, by the end of this movie, maybe she's gone through the most growth of anybody over the course of this MCU. She's gone from this character who was a blindly loyal killer for Thanos to not only helping her sister out, but rebelling against her father and actively seeking to help these strangers on Earth who she would have never cared about before, to overcome Thanos, to overcome her dad, and to overcome her past self, and also to save her sister from that fate of being just like her. I was really touched by pretty much all the Nebula scenes in this movie. The stuff with her and Tony at the beginning, where she and Tony are bonding and she's helping Tony as he's seemingly about to die. And then, of course, all of the sacrifices she makes by the end of the movie, even trying to, you know, when she's trying to talk her old self out of helping Thanos, the humanity that she's gained, even though she's so much robotic and everything. That subplot really connected with me in a way that I don't think I was fully prepared for.
Agreed. And so much credit to Karen Gillan. Mm-hmm. I mean, she... Yep. Considering how she looks, you know, she brings just this crazy depth to this character, and so much that you, like, when you know future or present day Nebula, and then you have to see her interact with past Nebula, how much you hate past Nebula, it's just totally amazing. And I've always been a fan of Karen Gillan, but like this, I think was just next level for her, and it makes me super excited that she brought all of that emotion to such, like you said, robotic character. And kind of low key stole several scenes for me.
I really liked her her poignant scene with Rhodey right after they got the Power Stone, when she just kind of is, because you've never seen her self conscious about what Thanos has made her into, and all of a sudden she is for just a moment, and she says, "I wasn't always like this." And of course, Rhodey can't walk without the suit, and so he's like, "Neither of us was I, but we work with what we've got." Mm-hmm. Like they kind of connect on that.
I would say that I just believe Nebula's pain a lot more than I do for other characters. And I think that is a credit to Karen Gillan's performance.
Mm-hmm.
She just really, really goes for it. Despite, as you said, all the CGI and makeup and practical whatever going on there, there's still just such a humanity. And yeah, that scene between current/future Nebula and her past self, she of all people knows the desperation that this person is going through, the lengths that they will go to, because she was that person, and she can put herself in that same mindset. And we see just the miles of growth that have taken place over the course of just a few movies, really. And that was one that I was really looking forward to, what kind of arc she was going to have in this film, since she was one of the few survivors, just sort of on the Guardians side of things. And I just recently watched both Guardian movies back to back, like right before this. And it was like, yeah, that's right, Nebula's still around. What's going to happen with that? And of course, you're wondering as well, from the Infinity Gauntlet comic, she plays a very different role there, but still pretty prominent. And is that going to play out in some form or fashion? So she was definitely one like you wanted to keep your eye on throughout the movie.
And then having the courage to do what she does to her own self at the end, just, you know, that level of like, okay, this is enough. And like really doing everything she could.
I would have liked if maybe she had exploited that kind of digital link that she had with her past self and like used that to her advantage in that kill. I mean, we didn't lose anything for that not happening, but I was thinking about it after the fact, and I was like, that would have been a cool little payoff. But, there was plenty that they fit in, so there's no way they could have fit everything in
even a 3-hour movie. Well, you know, Tim mentioned the previous two Guardians movies, and I think back to, I think it was in the second movie, there's a moment when she's arguing with Gamora, and she says, "I wanted a sister," and that was kind of the moment that character turned for me, and I was like, I get it now. Like, that, suddenly, I viewed the character in a whole new light, and that really comes to fruition here. The scene with Rhodey, the scene with her past self, where she has to make that decision, because in that moment, you know, it was not a hesitation. She doesn't hesitate to save her sister. And I think that we also see a great, I'm interested to rewatch the movie to see if this plays out the way that I remember it playing out. But like, you know, this is a character for many years, for most of her life has been defined by trying to appease her father to earn Thanos' approval. And in his last moments, right before Thor cuts his head off, what does he say to her? He says, "Perhaps I've judged you harshly, daughter. Thank you." Because she says he wasn't a liar. And I think that was a moment for her that was almost the final nail, that moment of approval from him ultimately meant nothing to her.
Right? Yeah.
And I think that was a very key moment that maybe a lot of us, including myself, overlooked at the time. But as I look back on it, how I remember that playing out is kind of that's a moment for her that from that point on, she's a totally different person. And she's now put that part of her past behind her.
There's a really good Lindsay Ellis video on YouTube that talks about how Guardians 2 is kind of a display of different abuse dynamics and how they affect your relationships with your siblings and with your parents. And it delves pretty deep into the Nebula Gamora relationship. And I would recommend watching that.
Yeah,
it really gives you a lot of insight into Nebula's character, too.
You're going to have to give that a watch for sure. Because that's a dynamic that really spoke to me in the second Guardians movie, even in Infinity War. So looking forward to that. And then we've been talking about all the ancillary characters. Let's talk about the main eventers for a moment here. We mentioned Thor very briefly, going through his Fat Thor phase.
Fat you Thor. Know?
We need to He's talk moved. About Fat Thor, I think.
How much do we love Fat Thor?
I love, as an Atlanta resident, that he was drinking a Creature Comforts beer.
He's reached his Fat Thor phase. He's moved into his equivalent of Graceland. He's one step away from dying on the toilet. First of all, credit to whoever did the fat makeup on Thor to make him look fat. I'm sure Hemsworth didn't actually get fat for the movie, but and join the rest of us. But you know, the makeup they put on him looked phenomenal. It looked great. It was a hilarious visual from the get go, and everything from stuff getting stuck in his beard, which was great.
Yeah, I thought that the grimy beard completed the ensemble.
It
more
did.
Than
the ensemble, it sure did.
Yes.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
I think I said it in our spoiler chat, but talk about ballsy moves. You have Chris Hemsworth, one of the most beautiful human beings on the planet, and it's not a situation where all of a sudden he's let himself go, he's gotten old, he's, you know, just naturally gotten kind of pudgy here. No, he's still Chris Hemsworth. And you're going to pile on, like, whatever CGI or fat suit or combination of the two and just make him kind of what he is here and stays throughout the duration of the film. Like, they don't try to walk this back at the end. They're like, no, he's kind of fat now, and that's just how it is. And that doesn't mean he can't make a contribution, you know, when the chips are down.
I kept waiting for them.
Because right. it's not like he suddenly turns muscular and skinny again. No, he's still Fat Thor that whole last
He's still
fight.
Fat Thor the whole time. He just finds the resolve that had been missing in these kind of just this 5-year funk that he'd been in. There's already been lots of like think pieces written about how this is fat acceptance, how it isn't fat acceptance. I'm just like, I guess I'm still just in awe that they mm-hmm. went there. You know what
and
I mean?
And it kind of addresses something that I've always thought about where characters like Thor or Superman, it's like their powers are not based on bodybuilding, right? Like they have like if Superman was a skinny guy, he would still be just as powerful as he is. It just so happens that he's not.
Yeah, wouldn't it actually be harder for Superman to get muscular because he'd have to lift so much more? The gym doesn't have enough weights.
You'd have to have the Grant Morrison thing where he's like got an atomic dumbbell or something.
Atomic dumbbell.
But it was such a ballsy move, as you put it, Tim, because he kind of looks like Thor by way of Jeff Bridges.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it was definitely,
which they directly reference by saying that at one point.
Yeah,
and then they also call him Lebowski.
Yeah.
And then they also have him in like the dude sweater or the dude shawl thing from Big Lebowski,
which I still like to think of as a callback to Obadiah Stane,
right?
So Nick, I'm interested to get your take as a big Thor fan. What did you make of this subplot? What did you make also, because I have not read many Thor comics in my day, except, you know, Jason Aaron a few little bit and some of the Simonson stuff. But what did you make of New Asgard just sort of being this port town somewhere
that,
in America?
I mean, that's not that. No, it was in Norway. It's actually in the in the town that Red Skull visits in Captain America, the First Avenger, and is also the place in Norway that we see Odin fighting alongside the Vikings against the Frost Giants in flashbacks in the first Thor movie. So that town, Tonsberg, actually is in and of itself a callback to early MCU stuff from Phase 1.
Maybe
the new Asgard,
also where Odin died, was it? From
I believe so as
Ragnarok?
Well, yes.
Can't remember, but maybe.
The implication that you got over the course of the Thor films was that Odin had something of a connection to this place. It was his spot on Midgard that he liked to come for whatever reason. So the location of New Asgard in this one is kind of a combination of influences from the MCU and also the Oklahoma bit from the comics, where Asgard is destroyed and Asgardia, which is what they call it in the comics, is created over this spot of barren land in Oklahoma that features prominently in the J. Michael Straczynski run, in the Kieran Gillen run, and then into the Jason Aaron run as well. So that actually has some pretty deep roots into the last 10 to 15 years of Thor comics. So the new Asgard thing, totally on board with it. Was honestly expecting that we would see that at some point after the way that Ragnarok ended. As far as Fat Thor goes, I mean, I figure you probably are waiting for me to complain about it, given the fact that they used it for comedy at times. But the thing, I wasn't upset because they used it for comedy, because they clearly made it known that he was acting this way as a defense mechanism, as a coping mechanism, mm-hmm. because he was unable to deal with the fact that, like I said earlier, his pride and his ego had been crippled for the first time in his life. He had taken all the actions that he thought he needed to take to win the day, whether it be going to Nidavellir and building Stormbreaker and attacking Thanos, whether it was attacking Thanos again on the garden and chopping his head off, and all these actions he has taken for the last, you could argue through the events of Infinity War and even Ragnarok as well, none of it ultimately mattered. He still lost in both instances. And eventually he gets to a point as a character where he's like, if all I'm going to do is lose, what the fuck is the point in trying anymore? And he gives up, and he's broken as a character. So Fat Thor's fine with me, because then after we see him broken, we get to see him regain a sense of who he was. And so we get to see him go through the valley and come back out on the other side.
One of the many stand up and cheer, huge pop moments in the theater when we watched it the other night was when Thor gets both Mjolnir and Stormbreaker at the same time, and the lightning flows through him. That was such a badass moment.
Even opening night, just getting Mjolnir back during his trip to Asgard, during the time travel portion, our theater applauded for that. I know I certainly did, because I have made my thoughts clear on many of the narrative decisions that were made in Ragnarok, and that's certainly one I wish that had never happened. So getting to see him hold Mjolnir again was a cool moment for me personally.
And it also speaks to the fact that he's still worthy, right?
Right.
So it comes right to him, just like it would any other time, that he is, the worthy, strongest Avenger, if you will. And I think people were also kind of cheering, not just for that, but also kind of the anticipation of, oh, well, this might be leading to something else, which was a scene that people had been calling for years and years and years of these films, ever since there were, these iconic characters all together in one movie. And you kind of thought that was not really going to happen after the events of Ragnarok. So I think there is a tinge of anticipation in there as well, him getting the original hammer back. Of course, that follows a pretty good exchange between he and Frigga.
Yes.
Who was treated somewhat unceremoniously in these prior films. So
yeah, but she finally got the role she should have had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somebody finally realized they had freaking Rene Russo standing there the entire time and had an opportunity to use her. And so the Russos, in their infinite wisdom, said, hey, why don't we actually let her have scenes, which I know is a novel concept.
Yes. And it also parallels so nicely the scenes with Cap and Tony get in the time travel sequences with people that they love, that they have lost, that had an impact on their lives. But with Thor in particular, it was a moment where it's his clarity, and it comes not from Odin, which we've seen before, and it comes not from Loki, which we've seen before, but it comes from his mother, which we hadn't seen before.
Right.
She really gets a chance. We get a chance to see that relationship. And let's face it, superhero movies and superhero comics are not great about balancing parental relationships. Usually it's either one or the other that is more closely related to the character. Batman stories, for whatever reason, are obsessed with Thomas Wayne at the expense of Martha. Superman stories, they kind of go back and forth, really. But Spider-Man, of course, it's always Aunt May. It's, is his mentor figure. And Uncle Ben's, dead, so can't really have him. But, I think in this case, we needed something to give her a chance to shine and give her just as vital a role in Thor's life as Odin had, because his life is not defined just by Odin. It's defined just as much by her. So I thought it was a great scene and a great moment for him and for her. And kind of gives Thor the way when you were describing it, Nick, about how his pride and ego had been shattered, so he just figures, what's the point? It kind of mirrors in a way what happened to Hulk, where he was so embarrassed by his loss to Thanos that he didn't want to come out anymore. He was just he was ashamed. And we'll get to Hulk, I'm sure, in a little bit as well. But let's move on to one of the other members of the MCU Holy Trinity here, and let's move on to Captain America, Steve Rogers. We've already talked about him a good bit here on the show, but Cap at the beginning of this movie is in a very rare position for him, right? He's in a position of doubt, a position of depression, a position where for once he's not convinced of his, you know, how is it Black Widow puts it, your undying optimism or everything's going to be great. And he's not convinced of that anymore, but he wants it to be the case. And over the course of this movie, we see Cap be put in so many situations where things could get screwed up along the way. And every time he is so determined to get this right, because think of all the obstacles they face when they go back in time. Mm-hmm. And they screw things up one after another. They screw up, but yet he is not going to take no for an answer. This has got to work. And we get that the tremendous Cap and Tony going back to 1970, and it gives us one of the best Iron Man bits in the movie. But we also have Cap identify the love of his life, see her, and that sets the wheels in motion for what happens with him later on. We also, before that, in the first flashback sequence we get to relive some fan service that throws back to Winter Soldier, which I think all of us appreciated that elevator sequence, right?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. So definitely. Much.
And the America's Ass variant.
I love – oh, go ahead, Jen.
And since when did he start cursing is what I wondered.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm totally fine with it. But
I actually loved that entire sequence because, like, he goes on think of Captain America 10 years ago, mm-hmm. when in this movie universe, where he's yelling at the other Avengers at various points for cursing. He is as straight laced and idealistic as you can get. Now you pass the New York incident, you pass Ultron, you pass Winter Soldier, you pass Civil War, you pass Thanos. Suddenly, Cap's got some edge to him. Mm-hmm. Cap's dropping some casual curse words here and there. Cap, he goes on the elevator, and rather than, okay, if anybody would like to get off, now is your chance, rather than that and start a big fight scene like he would have done 10 years ago, he whispers "Hail Hydra" to trick them to get the suit, to get the briefcase. Then he comes out and he fights a younger version of himself from Winter Soldier. And in order to win the fight, he has to cheat. Would not have done. So in that scene, without needing to explicitly say it in any dialogue in the movie, it shows how Cap has changed over the course of these 10 years. In a way he becomes more self-interested rough around the edges, while Tony is actually becoming more selfless as the movies go on. Yeah, I think
that was in the article that Russell had sent us earlier today, mm-hmm. that it's like they have these kind of opposite journeys. One has to learn to love others, one has to learn to look out for himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, they influence each other in that way. Yep. They learn from each other in that way.
That's a good point.
I think that there's just some sort of, and not like you said, like not a lot of action, like real action up until that point where Cap fights himself. So you were kind of like real ready for that. And then it was totally pays off when he has to cheat and then looks at his own ass.
Looks at his own ass.
The way that he stands there and contemplates it for a second. He kind of. He could have just walked away, but he had to, like, contemplate and then comment on it.
Yeah, he had to think about the ramifications of what he was about to say. Like, is this really going to be true if I say it? And
whole theater popped when he said "Hail Hydra."
Yep, absolutely. Yep. And then, so the So we get this incredible arc for Cap where he comes out the other side, and then the big fight happens and things are not going well. It looks like everything was taken care of, but damn it, here comes Thanos from the past of all things with his entire army at his beck and call, and he's coming to get the Infinity Gauntlet and to do everything anyway that they just thought that they stopped him from doing. And Cap and Tony and Thor have this knockdown, drag-out scene where they're fighting Thanos for the fate of the universe, and he gets knocked down, and then that moment that you referenced him, Thor's in trouble. Thanos has Stormbreaker in his hands. He's driving it into Thor's chest, and then here comes Mjolnir, but it doesn't go to Thor. It goes to Cap. And then, just as important as that moment, which was the biggest stand up and applaud moment in the movie, that was such an enormous pop. The decibel meter was broken on that one. But as if that weren't enough, Thor's reaction to it was pitch perfect.
Yes.
Because he's not mad, he's not angry, he's not jealous. Again, that thing that we just talked about, 10 years of growth. Whereas in Age of Ultron, Thor acts like he's, you know, almost upset that Cap sort of moves the hammer. Here, he is excited. He is so happy. He's like, I knew it. He is delighted that Cap has the hammer. And Cap doesn't just have the hammer. Cap wrecks Thanos' shit with that hammer.
Yeah, he does.
That hammer.
Like, I love the fact that he throws his shield and then throws the hammer at the shield to cause a shockwave from behind him.
Oh, that was so beautiful.
He's calling down lightning. He's doing it all. Yeah. He's doing it all with that thing.
Honestly, that whole scene, like, I don't think because I've seen it in the theater twice now, and I don't think seeing it is amazing, but also seeing it in the theater does it so much more justice because you can the cheering and the clapping. Like, I've actually been watching YouTube videos of people in the theater reacting to that scene. It's phenomenal.
Just talking about it, guys, the hair,
the hair
is standing up on my arm.
Yes!
I used to make fun of people who clapped at movies in the theater. I stood up and clapped so goddamn hard in that scene. Certainly was not alone, but
GIF from the UFC where he's just clapping and chewing the gum?
Yes. I am one of those people, officially. I am all of us.
I had so many moments that were like just huge pop moments for me where I was like clapping and cheering and yelling. But that was the one. That was like mind-blowing moment for a comic book kid to see on the big screen. And I'm not even a Cap guy. I didn't grow up as a Cap guy. Like, I didn't read Captain America comics, but that's how great these movies have been, that they have made me a Captain America fan, and they brought me back to my childhood of wanting to see that moment happen on the big screen and to see it. You know, I said this after Infinity War, it made me 7 years old again and in the best possible way. You cannot direct an action sequence any better than that.
We also get the line at long last. We finally get the line from Cap, and it was kind of understated. I like the way that they did it. It's not this, you know, this booming Avengers assemble. It's sort of like, okay, I'm going to go ahead and say it now. I don't have to, but I'm going
to
say
it. I just want to.
Yeah. It's like, you can't do it and not say it, because at that point, you know, everybody had come back, and, you know, these portals are opening all around Thanos and his forces, and they're surrounded. It's like, you could just go at him, but nah, I'm going to say the line.
And as great as all those moments were for Cap, maybe the most definitive Cap moment was not even the hammer moment, not even Avengers Assemble, but it might have been Thanos. He's knocked out Tony. He's knocked out Thor. Cap's shield is broken.
Mm-hmm.
And the hope is lost. He looks up in the sky. The sky is dark.
Let's not forget, all that discussion about the Mjolnir moment. Cap wrecks Thanos' shit with Mjolnir for a minute, and then Thanos gets the upper hand and beats the hell out of him. And it looks like nothing. Not even Cap lifting Mjolnir. Not even that improbable series of circumstances is going to be enough to win the day. That's the point where it really looks like all is lost. And like Greg is saying, Cap is standing there, he's got Mjolnir, but he's got a broken shield that nothing is left. He's been beaten half to hell. He's probably, you know, close to dead on his feet, and yet he's standing there anyway, trying
He's actually laying on the ground at one point, and he digs the what's left of his shield into the ground, and he picks himself up, and he walks toward Thanos, who he has no chance of winning against. Like, that is superheroics. That is superhero comics 101.
And that shot of just Cap on the left and the entire army on the right.
Yeah, as big a moment as Cap lifting Mjolnir was for me, I think the moment of the returns was probably bigger emotionally. Because, like, you had – we all knew they were coming back in this movie. And so you had to be at least a little concerned that it might ring hollow just because of the inevitability of it all. But we had probably been separated – from the Hulk snap at that point, at least like 20 minutes, I would think. And so you had almost kind of not forgotten, but you would, you know, initially you're like, oh, where is everybody? And when they're not there initially, you're waiting and you're waiting and you're waiting. And then of all of the characters to have the first one be the return, to have it be Sam Wilson with the on your left bit as he pops out. What an awesome moment. Great callback. And it just like, it gets you, you know, it gets the senses tingling. You know, that hair, the goosebumps that Greg was talking about earlier, that's when they started to go for me. Because then, you know, you get Black Panther coming back through and Doctor Strange and the Guardians.
Valkyrie on her horse.
Her horse.
Oh, that was amazing.
When Peter Parker swings across frame.
Oh, my God.
That was like, it was my theater was already like screaming and applauding. And it just progressively built from like Sam to Black Panther to Doctor Strange to the Guardians. And then when Peter swung in, like the theater just like lost it. It exploded.
I was sobbing. Like it was ridiculous. Like,
Me too. Like I was crying the first time I saw it, because at that point I was like, not even from sadness, but from like just what I described as sheer nerd nirvana joy in terms of like, I've never seen anything like this on screen in my life. Like literally never before have I seen something that so accurately just like represents what major event comics look like. And it was happening in front of me. In glorious high definition. It was an incredible moment.
Truly. And I want to stick a pin in Cap for now. We'll come back to him in a few minutes, because I kind of want to tie his ultimate fate together with another character's ultimate fate. And that, and the character that I'm referring to is Tony Stark, Iron Man. Who kind of kicked off the MCU. And right out of the gate, I would say, I think Robert Downey Jr. might have saved his finest performance for last. He is magnificent in this movie. From when we see him at the beginning of the movie and he's accepted his death and he arrives on Earth, and he might be more broken than anybody, right? He's to the point where he just says, fuck it, I'm done. I'm finished. I don't want anything to do with any of this. We lost. It's over. I'm moving on. And he moves on, and he has a family. He and Pepper settle down, and they have a kid. And we meet Tony and his kid. And from the minute that we saw that he had a daughter, I said, oh, no. I said, they're going to do it. And there's that moment, you know, Tony rejects the Avengers when they come to try to get his help to learn the secrets of time travel.
Even before that, Greg, one bit from RDJ that I wanted to mention and that I loved so much. It would have been so easy for them to have Tony come back from space and have the shared mutual loss that they all experienced be used to wordlessly brush aside all of the past conflict between he and Cap, to essentially have them put bygones, you know, let bygones be bygones, and the conflict that we saw in Civil War essentially be considered ended. But no, Tony gets off of the ship. And then once he gets inside and is kind of sitting there and had a moment to reflect on things, he lets Cap have it. And for someone who has always kind of viewed both Civil War the comic and Civil War the movie through a decidedly pro-registration standpoint, everything he said was right. Like, Tony made these arguments years ago, and Cap said, oh, we'll lose together. Well, what was the point of that? What was the utility in having to lose in the first place? Like, Tony lets him have it, and I was kind of just sitting there nodding the entire time, because it was an example of, like, Cap having to do the morally right thing that wasn't the morally practical thing, and it's finally come back to bite him in the ass.
And you know, RDJ's performance there. Like, because he's not just, like, giving this speech and letting Cap have it, but he's obviously so broken. Like, he's emaciated. He looks like
death.
Like he's about to collapse, which he does collapse. But yeah, he looks like death. And
yeah, he looks like he's going cold turkey or something.
Yeah.
Like,
I thought he almost looked a little bit like Stan Lee. Like, almost a little bit, like with the specific glasses he was wearing and his hair.
Yeah.
I thought there was a little bit of a Stan Lee vibe to him there. But.
I thought that scene was maybe the best acting in this entire series of movies.
Well,
like he went for it. I was like, holy shit. I'm going to sit my ass down and shut up here.
and there's that moment where like, you know, we meet his daughter and he rejects the Avengers when they come to ask for his help. And we come back to Tony and he's sitting there and he's trying everything in his power not to figure this out while figuring it out. Mm-hmm. He's sitting there and he's talking to his AI and he's like, okay, do this or don't, you know, it's late. If you can't get it, it'll probably take a while. You know, he's trying to basically, he's almost solving this against his will. Like he's like, mm-hmm. he's trying to come up with any reason for it not to work. And then it works and he is deflated that it worked. He said, holy, you know, shit, I figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
I solved time travel. And then he's like, he kind of shuffles into the living room. Like, it's not like he's not rushing in there to say, hey, I solved time travel. He goes in there and he's almost defeated by it because he knows he wants Pepper to talk him out of it. Yeah. And then she doesn't. And there's that resigned look on his face. Like he knows what it means that this is what he must do, not what he wants to do, but what he must do. And that's such an evolution for Tony Stark from what we saw at the beginning of Iron Man. And then it goes into the whole deal with time travel. The heart to heart with his dad was so great because it tied up so many loose ends from like Age of Ultron, that scene where he's kind of learning for the first time that his dad was a human, that he wasn't just a monster. And this is kind of his chance to see him. And then the last thing that his dad tells him is that, you know, he wishes he could have a daughter because the son is probably going to end up being like him, where his own self-interests are more important than the greater good. And then when you tie that into what happens at the very end of this movie, the moment with Doc Strange and Tony, where Tony makes the decision that I'm going to make the sacrifice, and he gets the tying together line of I am Iron Man. This was already – I don't mean to emotionally break you again, Jenny.
But like, this sobbing.
This was the moment for me. Okay. Like, I had held it together for most of the movie. And this was the scene, like the fate of Tony was the scene where I really just I lost it. Like I was done. Like I could not contain it anymore. And that was his acting. That was the writing. But that was just the culmination of this entire series of movies. But then for it to culminate in this movie with this story for Tony and his arc and him making that choice. It was reminiscent. Tim and I have talked about this a lot, about my emotional reaction when I read The Death of Superman when I was a kid. This was probably the closest superhero movie feeling that I can recall to having that for a death in a superhero movie anyway. Like it was like this and Logan were probably the two that stand out to me as superhero deaths that impacted me like this on the screen. And yeah, I can't say enough about Robert Downey Jr. I just read an article that he earned some ridiculous like $75 million for this movie. He earned every goddamn bit of that money.
Yep.
So.
Yep.
Plus he gets back end. Apparently his deal included a higher cut of the profits of this film than others did. So that $75 million probably going to grow substantially over the next 40 to 50 years. his estate will be cashing checks off this film for the rest of our natural lives.
Well, people forget what a huge risk and kind of liability he was when this whole thing started 11 years ago. You know, RDJ was...
He was a punchline.
Yeah, he was a punchline. He was kind of a Hollywood punchline, and this was going to hopefully maybe be his big comeback, but nobody knew what Iron Man was going to do as a movie, and he did not get paid.
Greg and I used to have, like, pretty heated arguments about the concept of an Iron Man movie.
Mm-hmm.
The Iron Man movie that they seem to be making.
And I could tell you, like, at the time, kind of similar to Sam, I'd been following the development, and I thought it was going to be good, but I didn't think it'd be the hit that it was, you know?
Right.
And I understand he took, well, I think he was just basically told, you're not going to make what your co-stars in this film are making. He was like, maybe third in line behind Gwyneth Paltrow and Terrence Howard. of all people. And we see how this works out. And in exchange, it's like, you know, you'll get some back-end points if this ever amounts to anything.
Yeah, his agent ended up being the smartest guy in the room.
Apparently, so. Wow. But, you know, I mean, there was every chance that, you know, they do that movie, they maybe do Hulk, and it sort of fizzles out for whatever reason. But, man, what an empire that has been built here since those early days.
And Jenny, go ahead.
All day long, I've wondered, like, okay, I'm going to have to talk about this tonight, and, like, how is that going to happen? Because I was just a fucking wreck. I mean, just, like, devastated. Like I think the closest person that felt the way I did was you, Greg. And I know everybody else kind of did, too, but, like, I felt like we were a little bit more.
Yes.
I thought about you for sure in that scene. Like, and I felt so bad, too, just because I was picturing a scenario going in where Cap and Tony maybe both die, but if they don't, then Cap definitely dies. But I did not in a million years think that Tony Stark is, like, he and Natasha are the ones to die, right? Like, I just was in denial, really, when that happened. So,
no, when I saw his
so
kid,
yeah.
When I saw his kid, I was like, oh. Jesus.
Yep, I was like, they're gonna do it, and I think, to your point, Jenny, I think you and I have always been kind of team Iron Man from the beginning of this franchise, and I think RDJ has been probably my favorite performer in virtually every movie he's been in, maybe Hemsworth in Infinity War, but they were pretty equal, and for me, my attachment to the Tony Stark character at this point, let me be clear, to the movie Tony Stark character, was so strong that I felt it. But I knew you would especially feel this one.
Yeah, I like, this is the first time I've ever cried on a podcast, so fuck all y'all.
Oh my God.
Because I didn't do it. You did, because I didn't know if I wanted to come on here and talk about this, but y'all talked to me.
Well, this is true. We did say you had to do this.
You did. It was on your
But this is content. This is what the people want. I mean, you know, you're doing a public service. I'm sorry, we're kind of profiting from your pain here, but
if I could be any eloquent about it, I guess it would be worth it. But I'm not, it just broke me. Like, I couldn't even watch half the scene. I had my eyes closed, just dying. For most of the scene, especially when Peter comes up. Like, I just turned my head away. I couldn't even watch that. And then Pepper, just so fucking brave, and just slayed me.
Yeah, and when she says we're going to be okay.
It was like, I'm not. Like, I'm not going to be okay.
Rhodey got me, because here's a guy that's been with Tony from the beginning and has always been able to have his back and to stop something like this from happening. And there's not a damn thing he can do about this. And he knows it. And, you know,
and that scene, such a powerful little bit later between Happy and Morgan.
Oh, my God. Oh. Yeah. That was honestly, like, they were very clearly trying to elicit an emotional response during that entire funeral sequence. And they were very effective. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But, like, I thought that little bit, I believe it's Favreau's only bit of spoken dialogue in the movie, I think that was more effective at just destroying me than Tony with the good, you know, the digitized goodbye speech was. That was great, don't get me wrong, but like, when Favreau is talking to the kid and the kid asks for cheeseburgers, like, Favreau doesn't get enough credit, I don't think, a lot of times, for how damn good of an actor he is. Like, he could have gone very obvious and, like, broken down in that scene, or he could have had some hugely over the top emotional response, but he plays it all through facial reactions, and it's so understated where you can see him, like, almost break but somehow hold it together. And, like, a great callback of, like, your dad liked cheeseburgers, I'll get you all the cheeseburgers you ever want. Like, that was And this is the moment.
Oh, no.
This is the moment I must pause here to say the thing I told Tim after seeing the movie. I don't often make demands of things I must see in films going forward. But if I don't get Peter Parker as a protective older brother going forward in the MCU, they can go directly and fuck themselves, as far as I'm concerned.
That was a great moment, but I got to be honest, the I Love You 3000 broke me more than that. I was gone. I was blubbering at the point of that. Like, I had to like lower my head at one point because of the I Love You 3000 thing. Complex parental issues. I don't know, but
I missed the I Love You 3000 callback with the hologram the first time I saw it. I just missed it when I was watching it because I was still in shock from everything that had just happened. But the second time, I was like, oh, God, yeah, ooh.
And it was so quiet during Tony's death scene that I had this, like, just ginormous sob, like, locked in my chest. And, like, it was so quiet.
I know what you mean, because you don't want to be the one that's, like, the drawing the attention of everybody, right?
Like, and it was just very physically hurting me, like, hard to, like, not break down, even though it was happening internally. And everybody, like, I think that once you got over that little part, you could hear like more sobs and sniffles throughout the crowd. But that moment was just pin drop quiet, and just, it broke me. I mean, hard.
And to give Tony that kind of a farewell moment, that would have been enough for the emotional crux of virtually any movie, but they weren't done yet.
They weren't done yet.
And they go to the opposite side of the emotional spectrum. And gosh, I'm turning this into a Green Lantern podcast. No. So they go to the opposite.
We've done that.
That was our Captain Marvel podcast.
God damn it, Nick. So we go to the other end of that, and we have Captain America, and as Tim was suggesting, I think all of us figured going into this movie that Steve Rogers wasn't making it out alive.
Yeah, he was. Him and Nebula were in my Deadpool.
Yep, same here. And at the end of the movie, Tony, Cap goes back in time, of course, and there was a part of me, and that when he saw her in 1970, it did click in my mind that maybe they're going to revisit this. But I thought to myself, that was Cap's temptation moment, and he resists it. And he goes back because he's got to do his job. But then once the job is finished, they do what I call the Dark Knight Rises treatment, which can be very divisive among fans. And this scene has been divisive among fans to a degree. But I cannot tell you how much I love this, because I've talked to people about how I broke down at the end of the Dark Knight Rises. And I did the same thing for this, because that last shot, I don't think you could have found a better last shot for this movie. That was the perfect... there's this Twitter account that's like, I think the name of it is like Perfect Shots in Film or something like that. And it's great.
One perfect shot.
Yeah. One perfect shot. Yeah. This needs to be on there, because that shot of Steve and Peggy finally kissing for real at the end of this movie and getting their life together, getting their dance together, the one that Cap fantasized about back in Age of Ultron, but thought would never happen. It's one of the great moments, one of the great inspirational moments in film for me. Like, for me personally, from the kind of movies that I like, those were tears of a totally different emotional spectrum. I can't remember the last movie that made me cry tears of sadness and tears of joy within what, a 15-minute sequence of one another.
The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, Dark Knight. I haven't had the same emotions.
Oh yes.
Like, specific mix of emotions in a movie since Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah. And that's what I told Tim. You know, when we were discussing the movie after I saw it Thursday night, I was like, you know, and I was trying to encourage him not to use this as a reflection of the quality of the film, because I know he has different opinions on Dark Knight Rises than Greg, than you or Sam or I do. But like, okay. I said I haven't been this emotional in a movie theater since Dark Knight Rises. And I was like, consider the source that's coming from and the equivalency that's being drawn there. Like, I referenced this earlier and Tim kind of pressed me on it already, but like, I have always said for the last like 7 years that my three favorite films of all time in any genre, no matter what, are Chris Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy. And I'm very tempted to say that it's now kind of a top four with this in the mix. That is how much I love this movie.
I believe you actually said, and correct me if I get this wrong, that the weakest installment of the Nolan trilogy of Batman films, the weakest one for you, was still better than the best movie, your best movie of the, MCU, the entire MCU.
Yep.
And I was just kind of like shook, you know.
Mm-hmm. That is no longer the case. I'll put it that way.
That's a statement.
I'll say that definitively. Like
that is a statement, and I'm shook once again.
it's, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about. We'll have years to dissect where this place is all time in terms of like superhero films and stuff. But like, I don't really even know where I would have it contextually right now. Like I am very tempted to say it's my second favorite movie I've ever seen, and that's that is incredibly high praise.
Tim. Yeah, I went to Jenny for Tony. I want to go to you for Cap because I know that's your guy. I want to let you talk about what that ending for him signified for you, what you thought of it as a Cap fan, and kind of your feelings on how the Steve Rogers story seemingly has ended in the MCU.
Wow, where to start? So I would say tears of relief, tears of joy, tears of triumph, just filled me with warm feelings of gladness. The Cap send-off that we got in this film, just me as a Captain America mark dating to the time I was probably 8 years old and never really having one of those moments where I fell out of love with the character or walked away or gave up on this character, to have been rewarded in this way just means the world to me, kind of. I mean, we can complain about fan service and how, you know, narrative integrity is often sacrificed at the expense of fan service, but I think they gave us the best of both worlds here. It was kind of the right decision to make and was such a huge crowd pleaser. And I was so afraid that, you know, in my own kind of cynical mind, that Steve would die, get kind of the hero's death in this movie, and kind of be reunited with Peggy and the afterlife. And she's just kind of, while it would be nice, it's just sort of messed up in a way to reduce her to his reward in the afterlife. You know what I mean? Like, we know that she lived a full life of her own. She married, she accomplished great things. I mean, she certainly never forgot about him, but for all intents and purposes, she moved on. So it would just be kind of a weird ending to do that. But what they've actually done is preserved everything we knew, everything we loved about Peggy, and still gave Steve this fairy tale ending. And man, there's just so much that, you know, I could go on and on about this, and I'm trying not to monopolize the podcast, but I mean, you look at what it says about his character too, that all he really knows about Peggy's life in terms of the details, he knows that she founded S.H.I.E.L.D., that she was kind of a badass bitch. She was really into him in World War II. And then she dies in a kind of really cruel, horrible way, in a very ordinary way that, I mean, he witnessed. He was kind of there for. And he still looks at that and says, yeah, I'm all in. I want to do that. I want to make a life with this person, kind of knowing how it's going to end. And that's, wow. I mean, that's powerful stuff.
It super is, and I super agree with everything that you said, but my black, black, broken heart just just hated it. Like, just fucking hated it. That he got to do all that, and Tony had to die.
And Tony didn't. Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. I would look. That would be me. I would totally be in your same position. You know me. I would be saying the same thing if the shoe was on the other foot.
I mean, it's beautiful and blah 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 and fine, whatever.
Yeah, because we talked about earlier how it kind of like it almost is more emotionally resonant to have those two swap fates essentially, yeah. Because everybody would think that Tony gets, you know, the big satisfaction, that Tony gets all the things he ever wanted in life and gets the self-satisfaction of getting to go off with his family at the end. You know, we would all think that would be more in line with the Tony Stark character, and we're all anticipating Steve, you know, laying down his life. And when you get the inverse of those two things, as we've been talking about, it just shows how much those two characters learned from one another. And ultimately it can be even taken as a subtle show of respect between the two characters that they listen to each other, in terms of, you know, Cap telling him way back in Age of Ultron, you're not the guy, or, you know, you're not the guy to make the sacrifice play. Or maybe that was the first Avengers even.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tony telling Cap all the time, you got to get a life, man. And then he says that at the end, if I finally tried some of that life that Tony was always talking about. And I wouldn't change. Like, as much as I was emotionally devastated by Tony dying, I don't think there's a single thing I would change about this ending, honestly. Like, it was
that's
it was
another
perfect
level of hurt.
I think I also, to be further G golly hokum and really alienate Jenny Moore, I'm sorry. I kind of like the message that it sends too, where it's, you know, you're looking at this character and you're thinking, well, the only logical conclusion here is, you know, he dies heroically. He's no longer relevant to the world anyway. And that's what his story is supposed to be. That's how these stories are supposed to be told, right? And it's kind of just saying, no, you've gotten a second chance. Learn from that. Grow. You've still got a seat at the table. I kind of like that it rejects the sort of weird way that we romanticize the hero's death in these movies. And not just in movies, and really, you know, any epic storytelling tradition. How it just sort of turns that on its head and says, no, you don't have to die. Like, you did great things. Go live your life now. You know, not so much this is your reward, but you should get, you know, something for yourself out of this. Like, hell, I mean, you've put in such great service now, and there's a whole world out there. So go enjoy it.
That has kind of been my argument for ending stories among superheroes, whether it's Star Wars or whatever you have. I think it's okay for the hero to ride off in the sunset. Like, these are all kind of modern versions of classic myths, whether it's the old Western or the old, you know, pulp novels or whatever. And sometimes it's okay, especially when you're working in a finite medium like film, it's okay for the hero to have a happy ending. Batman doesn't have to end up, you know, dead in a ditch somewhere because he got old and fat, you know? Like, it's okay to give
Are
these
you sure?
heroes some,
like,
some sort of a
cool.
sort of a read
what
some
the
Frank
fuck
Miller
is wrong with that?
But your point is well taken, yes.
Yeah, but, you know, like, it's one of the reasons why Batman Beyond never sat as well with me as it did with most people, because I just didn't like the idea of Bruce becoming this old bitter man that forces someone else to take up his mission, you know, the Frank Miller take on him, basically. So it's like, it's okay. In this case, Cap has more than earned this. He has sacrificed so much, and it's not what he's doing is that selfish, because what he's doing is not going to ruin the planet or hurt his friends or anything like that. What he's doing is essentially taking his retirement.
Yeah.
It's saying, and to God be damn it, yeah. What else do I have to do?
Yeah, and to be clear, I don't think that he just met Peggy, shacked up with Peggy, and kicked his feet up for 40 years or whatever. I think he kept on being Cap in however way, whatever form that looked like in this, you know, kind of new timeline he found himself in. I think he kept doing what he was doing, and
especially
until one
because
day he couldn't.
I read an interview with the Russos shortly before this where they said, yes, his life played out in an alternate timeline now.
Well, there we go.
And that somehow he found his way back to the main timeline just for that moment of passing the shield off to Sam. But so he could have very easily, like, you know, lived a life as Captain America with Peggy, like, gotten the best of both worlds. He doesn't have to just put down the shield and never pick it up again. And they hinted that in the interview, you may see that explored further, whether that's with Chris Evans or in some sort of flashback or whatever. So, You know, people who criticize the ending based on Cap would never lay down the shield and give up the fight. I don't think you necessarily have to look at it that way.
Yeah, I don't think he did. I don't read it that way at all. I mean, I do think that he outlived Peggy, however, whatever her fate was in the life that they shared together. You know, he's going to outlive people just by virtue of the fact that he has the super soldier serum.
Now, I preface this by saying, obviously, I don't like this happening to her, but I like the idea from a narrative standpoint that she ends the same way that she did in our timeline, because Cap still, you put it beautifully in our spoiler thread, Tim, about how he knows he's going to lose her, and he knows he's going to lose her in this horrible fashion, but it's still worth it to him to be able to have a life with her.
Right.
It's like that
Mitch Hedberg bit where you say, hey, if you eat that apple, eventually it's going to be a core. Well, yeah, but...
Exactly. But I get the apple. So,
yeah.
So, right.
It's exactly right. Like, it's and in many ways, it's another example. It's another example of Cap's bravery. And Cap's... This is going to be an intense amount of pain for him, but it's worth it. And he goes, and he's willing to go through it, and he's willing to be there by her side to give her the support that it seemingly she didn't have at the end. So, you know, the guy that kind of gets fucked is her husband, the anonymous husband that she has. But
I think that our Peggy still married whoever she married.
Sure. And exactly.
This is just a different version and a different outcome. And, you know,
one story I want to see, even if it's just in I don't know, in some tie-in comic or something, but I'd rather see it in live action if possible. I would like to see a scene where Cap returns the Soul Stone.
Yeah.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. I would like to see all of the returns, honestly. I
know. That specific one, though, because it's Red Skull.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Him injecting the ether back into Natalie Portman.
Yeah, how did that fucking work?
That work?
Yeah. Oh, it worked the way how you did... think it works. Good for Natalie Portman, is all I'm going to say. I read an interview with the screenwriters as well they did today where they said that apparently, you know, this movie was 3 hours, and they said there's probably 18 to 20 minutes that were filmed and cut. So we'll probably get to see a lot of stuff in this in this DVD at some point. Whether or not those returns are part of that, I don't know. But they specifically said there was like a good bit of footage from the closing battle that was cut, where the battle itself almost had a three-act structure upon initial creation. So we may see an extended version of that battle coming to our television sets pretty soon.
You know what they could do? There's this little thing called Disney Plus supposed to be launching later this year, right?
Yep.
And Disney Plus, it's hard to believe that I'm saying this, but it's going to need some content. some content that isn't just their back catalog, in other words, which is all the content anyone could ever possibly want.
Anyone has ever made in Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah. But I know that they're going to want some original content. Let me put it that way. And, man.
Back the bricks truck up to Mr. Evans.
Well, if they've already filmed some stuff and kind of have it in the can... maybe they do a little something with that. I'm not saying like a whole movie or anything.
But short, you know. But
yeah, some kind of short maybe. That I mean, people are still gonna be hot for this MCU content. So
And you got MCU What If coming. So I mean, like, there's all kinds of stuff.
Yep.
That's gonna feature the voice actors, you know. So
yeah, so gosh, at this rate, this podcast is going to be 3 hours long, but there's so much to talk about here.
Yeah.
We've been focusing so much on the big three for the big two for the last, 40 minutes. But there are other characters in this movie that had a huge time as well. And I think one of those that we have to talk about here is, I know a character near and dear to Nick's heart, and that's Scott Antman. I thought.
Wait, no, you're doing that thing you do. Where you make it out like I hate the character. I actually like the character and the portrayal a lot.
Oh, you mean the thing that you do to me about every other character
I just think that the movies he's been in.
Jeff Jarrett, the Intercontinental title.
Have been a little boring. That's all I've said.
Well, regardless of the Ant-Man movies, which can be debated at another time, perhaps later this month.
Greg, you know, you asked me, we were talking about this on the phone earlier this week, and you asked, God, who were the major MCU characters who didn't appear in Endgame? We were kind of listening to
them,
and I was like, you know who didn't appear? Luis and the dumb fucks. That's who didn't appear.
You know who else didn't appear? The boring-ass Warriors 3.
They're dead. They were killed off.
I like the Warriors 3.
Beloved Taika Waititi. You know who did appear, though, and Luis didn't? You know who did, Greg?
Harley, the kid from Iron Man 3?
Yes!
Ned. Good old Ned.
Oh, God. Ned. He can die in a... If him dying in a fire means I have to lose Luis, take them both.
Can we sign these terms right now?
Because, you know, the whole Thanos prediction. I did see one theory that when Doctor Strange held his one finger up, he wasn't actually saying this is the one. He was saying shove Ant-Man up Thanos' butt.
Oh God. Well, Ant-Man is into that sort of thing, from what I recall.
Speaking of Doctor Strange and Scott Ant-Man, I did read some criticisms about how, the one in a million shot that he gets back to Earth from the quantum realm because a rat stepped on a series of buttons in the right combination. Well, I mean, I kind of think that plays into the whole strange
14,605 or whatever.
Yeah. Like,
I think this was the one out of however many where that specific thing happened. And
also, it's a Disney property. They're going to make a mouse the hero.
There you go. There you go. So I'm like, I'm really willing to give that one a pass.
Yeah.
Nick and I were talking about this earlier that we were, you know, yes, there are a lot of coincidences in this movie, but again, the entire existence of these superhero movies are Peter Parker happens to be bitten by a spider who is radioactive at that given moment, and he happens to have personal tragedy that will motivate him to become a hero. So like you have to accept a certain level of that, and I agree, that's how I viewed it as well. This is the one out of a ridiculous amount. So Ant-Man in this movie, I thought, was spectacular. I thought Paul Rudd gave his best performance yet. He was so fantastic anchoring so much of the comedy in the film and being this true, everyman. Like, he's just this normal schlub of a dude who is surrounded by literal gods and monsters everywhere. And how do you react to that situation? And also, Tim, you and I were talking about his undying loyalty to Captain America and admiration for Captain America. He's just, to him, Captain America is God. He's like, you know, he gives us the line, as far as I'm concerned, sir, that's America's ass.
That's right.
I mean, Paul, and only Paul Rudd, I think, could deliver that line and make it sound real, because he's so great at playing these everyman comedic heroes. And to me, I thought Ant-Man was one of my favorite parts of the movie. He was just, every scene he was in was good. He got great action moments. But really, he had so much heart and so much there was tragedy where he was looking for his daughter. He missed 5 years of his daughter's life, but he got him back. And he also was there to provide, of course, those great Paul Rudd sort of comedic moments that popped up along the way.
I will say the one thing that kind of gets me whenever Ant-Man appears outside his own titles is they never use his ant controlling ability. Mm-hmm. That's a huge part of what he does. Like,
true.
In that final battle, he could have thrown some expanders at some baby ants and had like a little army of ants helping him along. That would have been cool.
Maybe that's in the deleted scene.
I hope so.
Yeah, it's true. He usually, in fact, in these Avengers, well, if you count Civil War as an Avengers movie, he kind of uses the giant man powers more than anything else. He was great in the movie, and getting to see him sort of have to sort of try to understand time travel and all that, and that was fun.
How about Bradley Cooper as Rocket in this one? Like, of all the choices to leave alive at the end of Infinity War, Rocket was the one where I was kind of like, I guess you need a Guardian, but that sure is a weird choice. And then like seeing how it played out here, I loved it. Like, it was perfect.
Do y'all think that Nebula was intentional on Thanos' part? Like, he intentionally left the one of his children alive, still alive?
I get the impression that you don't. Well, then again, Tony used specifically snap away all of Thanos' forces. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't get that impression. I thought it was more just he was fulfilling his true, you know, the statement about it being absolutely random.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then also, like, I kind of don't know that he was necessarily telling the truth when he gave that whole monologue either.
Well,
that
considering was just he wiped out basically all of the Guardians,
yeah,
who he's probably the most pissed at that very moment.
But left Stark maybe. Alive, even though he had referenced, like, knowing, like, Stark was the only one he knew by name because he knew how big a threat he was.
I also thought it was, I don't think Thanos cared enough about Nebula to spare her.
I don't
either. Nope, me either.
He would have spared Gamora if he could.
Right.
But she was the only being in the universe that he actually loved, or thought he loved. But, yeah, so, another character that we haven't talked about is Hulk, who is kind of, now, this is one that I know Nick was particularly interested to get my thoughts on at the time because he knows how much
I was as interested in getting your thoughts on Hulk as you probably were my thoughts on Fat Thor. So.
Right. I have the somewhat unpopular in comic circles, perhaps, opinion. I've always hated Smart Hulk ever since I was a kid, which is what I read. I started reading Hulk comics in around 91, 92 when ponytailed Professor Hulk was a thing, and I didn't like him. I read his book because Juggernaut would appear or Spider-Man would appear, and I'd read it, and I was like, man, Hulk's kind of a jerk. I don't really like Hulk. He's kind of uninteresting, and he's kind of like Reed Richards, if Reed Richards was green and powerful, which is to say very boring. But
here come the tweets.
But that being said,
bring him on.
Of course, he didn't have propeller arms. What he does have is Mark Ruffalo. And I thought the way that they pulled off Professor Hulk in this movie, to me anyway, and I know a lot of hardcore Hulk fans will disagree with this because it was a very popular run of comics. I thought this version of the Hulk being smart was more compelling than any of the other smart Hulk versions that I've read. And that includes World War Hulk, Planet Hulk, whatever.
It felt like a true blending of the two personalities, whereas a lot of the smart Hulk stuff I've read is essentially just like Banner's personality in Hulk's body. And yes, Banner was able to retain some of his intelligence here, but it wasn't a constant stream of, like, you know, nerdy scientific bullshit coming out of Hulk's mouth. He kind of had this impulsive side, and he kind of was enjoying the fame, and you got the impression there was still some of that Hulk ego in there. So it really was like a perfect balance between the two characters that, you know, smart Hulk, I think, from what the limited amount I've read anyway, often missed that mark of balance to me.
There was humor to him as well. I mean, that's a big part of it. Like, he had a sense of humor. He was it was kind of like a marriage of Ragnarok Hulk and Ruffalo from the Avengers movies in a way that he wasn't just sitting around talking about Bunsen burners and stuff. Like, he was able to have, yes, he was smart, but he was able to have a personality and even a little bit of an ego. When you take in him taking the photos with the kids, elements of both their personalities kind of rubbing off on one another. To me, they pulled it off, and I ended up loving it, and I did not think I would. What did the rest of you guys think about the Hulk in this movie, who we've seen used to great effect in the prior Avengers movies in a different role?
I thought it was a nice touch that when the Ancient One pushed his astral form out, it was human. I thought that was a cool little touch. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the whole, like, listen to your mother, and, like, a lot of people some people online at least were pissy about him making a dab comment. I thought that was supposed to be him trying to be cool but being awful.
Yes, I thought so too, because Banner is not, you know, he's not going to have his finger on the pulse of pop culture, right?
Right. I thought he was introduced in the final scene. I can't think of having, like, seen him fight. The final.
No, I don't think. All he does is he lifts up the remains of the mansion with his one good arm, and then after that we don't really see him, I think, until the Stark funeral.
Yeah.
I do think that. Just the whole idea of the Hulk having that sort of performance anxiety that we saw in Infinity War. Sort of needed more of a proper reconciliation and
I can agree with
here.
That.
I don't think you want to spend like 30 or even 15 minutes of the film doing that, but I think it needed a little something, even if it was just like a montage or something.
Which I can agree with that.
It just, it was a little abrupt, and I get that was kind of the point, but I don't know. I just felt like it made his journey feel a little bit less complete. And you can also look at the whole, like I was saying before, trying to balance fan service versus story. There's a part of you that kind of wants him to see that rematch with Thanos.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't get it. And that was
I mentioned that to Nick. I would have liked to have had just one moment in the fight where maybe he gets to land a blow on Thanos.
Yeah.
Just to make him bleed his own blood.
Right.
You know.
And it's just one of those, like, was there really even room for it in this type? Like, mm-hmm. how many people are going to get over on Thanos? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
There's only room for so much of that. And
Cap, Iron Man, Thor, and Captain Marvel were the only ones who really got over on
Thanos.
That's
already kind of a lot, you know?
Yeah.
And, so there's that aspect to it. I guess I sort of respect the restraint and that decision. To sort of have him off on the side a little bit. He, of course, does get the great moment of holding up the collapsing Avengers compound. Reminded me of that iconic cover to Secret mm-hmm. Wars back in the 80s,
yep.
the original maxi series. So that was a neat and really unexpected kind of Easter egg, I guess you could call it. And of course he is the one who gets to do the snap to reverse everything. I mean,
he
gets some meaty material here. It's just, maybe not what you think of traditionally, the way Hulk would be utilized, but.
And what's amazing the usage of the Infinity Gauntlet, though it does hurt him and it renders his arm messed up and his face burned, it doesn't seem to have had as negative an effect on him as it did on Thanos. Because when we see Thanos at the beginning of the movie, he's limping, he's hobbling, he's a shell of himself, basically.
Yep. A couple of things for me, for Hulk, is I didn't expect him to be as funny as he was.
Mm-hmm.
I did enjoy his comedy here. And then also, why did him and Nat not get together?
Oh.
I think that they were both so emotionally wrecked after the events of Infinity War.
Well, what better
he
way
lost himself.
To like, you know, well, you have to reaffirm your work. Own life, you know, I'm just saying.
I think they fall into each other's arms. And
I think they both kind of got over that whole thing. Like, that was the implication I always got, is that
you think that because you want that.
I want that. And I think that was kind of what we saw play out in their last interactions with each other, even in the last movie and stuff.
And see, I kind of got the impression that, especially with Nat, like, she, when we see her after the time jump, she's kind of haggard looking. Like, her hair is kind of that weird mix of red and blonde that where you can tell she's not really paying attention to her appearance anymore. I think they reference at one point the fact that she's not really been eating or sleeping. She spends all her time, like, kind of throwing herself into the work. I think she became so, the way she dealt with loss was to become so single-mindedly obsessed with helping the people that were left in the world, doing what good she could.
And I think he did the same with his work, and that's why.
Right.
Didn't he say he exposed himself to low-level gamma radiation for 18 months?
Right.
Like, was he sitting in a chamber the whole time?
Right. So. And see, like, whereas in Age of Ultron, they were both kind of at a point where they were contemplating the idea of walking away, and I think, especially for her, and like Sam said, for him as well, they were so obsessed. They dealt with loss through obsession that, like, the idea of a relationship never even entered their heads, no matter how much there was clearly still affection for each other there. Because I think you see that in kind of the looks between them in the diner scene, and especially later on when Hulk says he tried to bring her back, and he has that show of rage by flinging the bench into orbit, essentially. Like,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
I think you get that impression. There's still a lot of feelings there between those two.
What a thoughtful answer to my throwaway sex-laden question.
Well, I think thing in this movie, though, is that you get, because while Nat and Clint, their relationship is not sexual at all, it mm-hmm. is the strongest relationship that either of them has with another person.
Totally agree.
And to add, like, to throw in any sort of Nat and Hulk romance into the same movie would have taken away from that.
And also, we don't know how many plastic surgeons were left after the snap. So the vaginal reconstruction surgery would have been necessary.
There's the answer.
After a bit of have been sexual intercourse between Hulk and Nat. We don't know what that would have looked like afterwards. So it's probably a risk reward, you know, a risk analysis scenario for her as well.
I'm not convinced they didn't do something. I mean, as the saying goes, well, sort of, 5 years, it's a long time. It's a lot that could have happened in there.
You're right.
And, you know, that's kind of serendipitous, because I think if they had made this movie in the 80s, Andre the Giant probably would have played the Hulk.
Could have played the Hulk, yeah.
Or just Ferrigno still.
Well, yeah, but Andre was, you know, even bigger, so.
Oh, that's right, Greg. TV actors suck and can't be in movies.
That's right.
How silly of me to forget.
Warner Brothers taught me that.
Wait, is this a Greg thing?
No. This is not a Greg thing. This is a Greg and Nick are angry at Warner Brothers.
I see.
Not letting Grant Gustin play the Flash on the big screen.
Clearly, Ezra Miller can act and Grant Gustin can't. That's what that's what Warner Brothers wants us to think, anyway.
I never knew that.
Oh my god. Anyway, so there's
Didn't they get a TV actor for Deathstroke though?
Joe Manganiello was Magic Mike by this point, or in Magic Mike by this point.
Oh, I only think of him from How I Met Your Mother.
there was just the big fight scene at the end, the big like hour long, whatever it is, feels like an hour long in a great way, fight sequence with Thanos versus the Avengers. It's such an amazing scene because so many characters get a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Whether every it's character. Valkyrie, every character really. Wong gets a moment, for God's sake. Doctor Strange, of course, gets a cool moment. And then I mentioned to you guys, one of the other pops in the theater and another favorite moment of mine was a payoff from the last movie where Scarlet Witch shows up and she's finally unleashed. And Thanos looks at her and she goes, "You took everything from me." And he goes, "I don't even know who you are." And then she goes, "You will." And then proceeds to wreck his shit for a few minutes. Amazing. Like, such a great this is like one of those great War Games matches where all the baby faces get a moment to shine. And certainly that was the case here. Giving Wanda a chance to finally let loose and give Thanos a little bit of a what for. And you know, and then one aspect that we also need to talk about that Nick and I have talked about is Captain Marvel in this movie, because she shows up and she is presented as a level of powerful that is beyond anyone else in the movie, probably including Thanos.
Right.
When
he headbutts her and she doesn't flinch.
Doesn't even flinch. Yeah, she just kicks the ever-loving crap out of everything in her place. She single-handedly demolishes Thanos' fleet, and much to, I'm sure, the chagrin of the ass-kissing Ebony Maw. And I mean, God, what a sycophant. So she shows up and she cleans house, but that's kind of her only role in the movie. She's gone for most of the movie after a lot of us kind of figured she would play a big
role. They kind of use her in very specific purposes. Like, she's used to show up and save Tony at the beginning, and then she flies back off into space, presumably after they defeat Thanos in the first 30 minutes. And then she even says at one point, "It'll probably be a long time before you see me again." It's one of those things where, like, it kind of bothered me, but the movie was so good that it's not enough to, like, really, it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And it didn't bother me because she wasn't the point of the movie. And
right, I get, yeah.
She gets great moments. Like, they're great moments. She gets a chance to shine. I think I do have a little bit of a concern going forward that they have made her so powerful that it's going to be hard for me to buy somebody as a threat to her, because they've shown us, you know, with Superman, you at least have a defined weakness and also his gullibility and just kind of naive nature. With her, she's street smart. She's badass. She's intelligent. She is seemingly more powerful than everybody. So they're going to have to do something to get me to swallow that anybody can be a threat to her going forward.
I think with them bringing in some of the more cosmic elements in the future, she's going to start seeing her match. But I liked how she showed up in the final battle after it was already going. So you kind of saw that you saw her, as opposed to just showing up and kicking ass, she showed up and was able to interact with a bunch of the other characters and get moments with the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I'm kind of like, I'm fine with them doing it again, but I'm kind of, I think this is probably the last time I want to see the, you know, she was just conveniently off in space the entire time. Mm-hmm. Thing. I think I'm going to need a little bit more than just she was off in space going forward. Like, it's been used a little conveniently, in my view anyway, to this point, and I'm kind of past
agree.
It.
I would agree with that, and I also think it was just very bizarre that she doesn't even get an introduction, which, yes, of course, we all know who she is. You know, you have confidence in your audience to see the last movie before this, but I don't know, just from the standpoint of this is a movie and it should be able to stand on its own, kind of just in terms of who your characters are. And I mean, the way that she just walks on screen is like, yeah. What?
I disagree. I liked that they did it the way they did it, because between the end of Captain Marvel, the mid credits of Captain Marvel, and the end of Infinity War, or the post credits of Infinity War, you really got everything. Like, we know that she showed back up because of the pager. We know that she got filled. We know that that stuff happened. We don't have to see it happen.
No, I mean, we don't have to. I just, yeah. It just,
and in a 3-hour movie, I think the way that they did it, it worked.
It's fine.
Well,
I
think, like, in this I don't see how this movie could work on its own, to be honest with you. Like,
no.
Not entirely on its own, but just from the standpoint of, now we've got a character that just literally appeared out of nowhere. I mean, it's
sort of like the sort of figure from the skies that just
I mean, even if you're watching Infinity War and this back to back, you're going, you know, if you have not dropped Captain Marvel in there in between, which I guess you're supposed to, it's sort of like,
because really, I mean, if you haven't dropped Ant-Man and the Wasp in there, then you're going to be like, where did he come from?
Right.
Well, that's the beauty of the universe.
Yeah. You're expected at this point. You're expected to have done your homework going into these movies.
Yes.
But yeah, and then I'm trying to think of what other characters we haven't touched on that had major moments in the movie.
Thanos,
my gosh, yes. So, Thanos, who was by and large in some ways I wouldn't want to say the protagonist, but in some ways the point of view character in Infinity War, is now a straight up villain. Like, we see a Thanos from the past. He sees that his ultimate plan was a complete and utter failure. Did not work out the way that he wanted it to. Of course, it's not his fault. Granted, to him, it's everybody else's fault. So for Thanos, now he's going to start over again and recreate the universe as it should be, as he puts it. So and yet here we also, and this is going to be one of my very few nitpicks with this movie. One thing that I wanted that I didn't get is, yes, he gets dusted in the end, and it's satisfying. He loses. We get that shot of Thanos looking around and befuddlement as everything. He refers to himself as inevitable so many times, right? He's inevitable. There's nothing they can do to stop him because he is destined for this. Well, how does that person who's so sure of his destiny, we've seen how the heroes react to failure. How does Thanos react to not just one failure, but the realization that everything that he's ever believed in his life is a lie? He's not destined for this. This is not what he was meant to do. And so one minor nitpick for me is, I wanted to have more time with Thanos dealing with his failure. After maybe everybody else gets dusted and Thanos is still there for a few more minutes at least, or even doesn't get dusted, but just gets killed some other fashion. I wanted Thanos to have some dialogue where somebody calls him out on his shit and Thanos has to deal with it. How does Thanos respond? Because that was what I was curious about. How does he react to know that he sacrificed his daughter's life for no reason?
This version of Thanos didn't realize
that he sacrificed his daughter, obviously. But like, how does he react to knowing that everything that he thought was so inevitable was not? And that in fact, all of these heroes banding together not only defeated him, but showed him the error of everything that he's been doing. And
I doubt he saw the error though. Probably that level of narcissism. Yeah. I mean, he went to dust thinking he was still right and that they were all wrong and that the bad guys had won.
Mm-hmm.
Like, somebody like that isn't going to see the error of their ways. They're going to just continue to be a douche.
How big was that moment when he gets the link or whatever between the nebulas and then sees the whole future. And like the whole theater realizes that he knows.
Yeah, I mean,
my heart sank.
Again, hair raising up on my arm because it was that tension. The tension. I felt the tension and I was like, oh my God, no. He knows. And then the smug look of satisfaction when he sees his own death. Because I think that in his mind's eye, I think he thought that Nebula killed him. And for a moment, he was actually proud of her for having the courage to kill her own father, you know?
Yeah.
There's it's a level of the kinks in Thanos' armor that we saw from the last movie where he's so convinced that he's a good man doing a good thing and he's the one suffering. Now we're seeing the narcissism and we're seeing the egotism and we're seeing the sadism that is really underneath all of that bluster, that it's really just not an act, but that he himself doesn't realize that it's that he's portraying that he's created this character for himself that is not real.
It's very
profound. I've heard a saying that if you scratch the surface of a martyr, you find a narcissist. Mm-hmm. And I think Thanos is a huge example of that because he spent the whole first movie acting like it was just this horrible thing that he had to do. And it was his burden and it was his curse.
His cross to bear,
His cross to bear. And now it's like, no, it's because he wants to be the ultimate when it really comes down to it. He wants to be the one who snaps. He wants to be, he wants to recreate a universe that's what he says, grateful to him. He doesn't want the universe to, like the whole too many mouths to feed. It's just his bullshit excuse. He wants to be worshipped, essentially.
And he even talks about that, I think, briefly in Infinity War. There's a line or two that he mentions there about, you should be grateful. You should be thanking me. And that's ultimately what it's about, is that he wants to look around and see everybody else realize that he was right.
Yeah, and that they were wrong. It's paralleled, like, in just one of the most eerie, uncomfortable ways in how when he's doing his invasions in Infinity War, that Ebony Maw is going alongside and essentially preaching the good word of Thanos and saying, you are all so lucky to have the privilege of being killed for the sake of Thanos.
Mm-hmm. You would think that if Thanos was as all powerful and as all knowing and as wise as he claims he is, he would realize that the Ebony Maw is a useless ass kisser and get rid of him. But no, he loves it. He wants it.
Well, you need a useless ass kisser.
Ladies and gentlemen,
my name is the Ebony Maw.
I wouldn't call him useless. He was pretty badass in his one action.
Yeah, he's quite effective.
Yeah, he did well.
He held his own.
Squidward.
Yeah, I kind of like this version of Thanos just as sort of a response to Infinity War Thanos, who, you know, was our protagonist, was our point of view character, and I think had the maybe unintended consequence of leading to a lot of kind of edgelordy YouTube videos of people going, well, when you think about it, Thanos was really right. And it's just like, oh, come on, guys, that wasn't the point of this movie. And, you know, they don't really walk that back here, but you do just see, like you were saying, Sam, just under the surface that how it's all just kind of a justification for his sadism.
Yeah.
And he's just a weird death cultist kind of thing.
Yes. So, and he's got his own little high priest.
Mm-hmm, got his own little high priest. And, you know, you could say, well, it makes him kind of a more of a two-dimensional character here. Well, yeah, but his story is over. You know what I mean? Like, we got the fully formed, fleshed out version of Thanos in Infinity War. If you want to look at that as a complete film, it's kind of the story of Thanos. It's his perverse hero's journey, which I can't say I was particularly swayed by, but I get what they were going for. And now that we've done that, we can kind of just get down to brass tacks as he's a shit heel villain here. And that really kind of worked for me. So I was good with it.
Even to the point of like Thanos at the beginning of the movie, post snapping, now is living his life on this idyllic farm planet. Everything's beautiful. Everything's wonderful. There's food is plentiful. He thinks everything is just great. Meanwhile, everyone else in the universe is suffering because of this.
Mm-hmm.
But to Thanos, he's created this world for himself that reinforces this belief that he was in the right for what he did.
One thing they do during that closing action sequence is I think they understand that these movies aren't really made in a vacuum. And what I mean by that is they know that there are legions of people like us who follow not just the films themselves, but the production of these films, the actor contracts, you know, and kind of hang on every detail. And I think they know that there was a certain level of expectation about, you know, part of the core cast of the MCU exiting these roles and kind of having to move on gracefully and trying to figure out what the universe is going to look like going forward, how they're going to accomplish that. And so during that closing action sequence, when Thanos is talking about building a new universe from scratch and then he gets the gauntlet, there was this brief moment in my mind. I was like, oh shit, he might actually win again. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought that for the briefest of moments. And it was a nice little way, you know, for them, I felt like it was playing with those expectations in our own minds in the middle of that action sequence.
True.
So, yeah, that was certainly a moment that could have been used to do that. The way they go about setting up the next generation of MCU films is kind of interesting, because we mentioned Cap getting his ride off in the sunshine moment, but he passes the shield before that. Nick and I have been convinced for a while that the Disney Plus series Falcon and Winter Soldier was going to be sort of a battle for the cowl type thing, where they were going to, at the end of it, one of them was going to be Cap. But here, it's pretty apparent Cap passes the mantle to Sam Wilson and makes him the new Captain America with Bucky's approval. And I thought that scene was just awesome. I thought it was a touching scene as well.
I think it was a great – because apparently there were some people who wanted to be Bucky, but mm-hmm. I say it should be Sam just for the reason that Bucky is from Cap's generation. Sam is living in his own time, and mm-hmm. he's of a new generation. But he also, you know, joined the military. He does the same – in Winter Soldier, he works at the VA doing the same thing that Cap is doing in the beginning of Infinity War. He is the new generation of Cap. And so it makes perfect sense to me. Like, if, you know, if he had been around in World War II, he might have been the one who got super soldier serum.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And Tim, what do you make of Sam getting the shield, being a big Cap fan?
No, Jenny's already laughing.
I know how you feel about legacy
characters. Here's the thing. Like, yeah, I've been critical of just the legacy hero concept, but in all honesty, that's just from being poisoned by 30 years of reading comics and seeing how it pretty much always plays out in comics. But in this kind of situation where you have what is a pretty legitimate passing of the torch. I mean, we have an actor whose contract has run out, who has all but said he's not only stepping away from this role, but kind of stepping away from the world of acting as well. You don't really have that specter of, well, they're just going to bring the original back, because, you know, the reality is actors age. They get sick of these things. They don't need the money anymore. And I can buy into it a lot more that we're not going to see, as much as it breaks my heart, we're not going to see another Chris Evans Captain America performance. So, you know, in lieu of that, yeah, I think that's the logical extension of his legacy, of his character, you know, keeping that in play, even though we no longer have the great performer that Chris Evans was and that he brought to this role. So,
did you have a preference on Sam versus Bucky?
I would say my preference is definitely Sam, only because here's a controversial take. I kind of think Sebastian Stan is a piece of wood as an actor.
Ooh.
I hate to say it because I like the character and I like what they've done in this series.
I don't 100% disagree.
I haven't seen a lot from him just as a performer in this series. I don't know if that's just what he's been given, but I mean, he's been in the kind of the best movies, but he individually as an actor, I'm like,
you know. I think he's gotten better.
Been brainwashed. I mean,
yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it could be just,
I thought he was really good in Winter Soldier near the end, having to play that, like that version of Bucky who's being torn apart by like his own psyche, like where he doesn't know what to do or the actions to take, and he doesn't know whether these things in his head are real or not. I thought it was outstanding.
I've grown to appreciate him.
Good.
I don't like him in the first Avenger at all. But I've grown to like him in subsequent movies, but I don't think it's a terrible take to have.
I mean, I just sort of look at it like, well, what's it really take to grunt and scream a lot? I mean, right. I hate to be that way. It's just that's all I've gotten from him.
Certainly, if you're comparing the two, I think Anthony Mackie has brought a lot more personality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I also think Sam just pointed out that, you know, he is the new Captain America. And I also think that he's different enough from what Cap is, personality wise, to give us a sort of a different look and a different approach to the character. Because I love legacy characters being a DC fan, but like, I've always liked it when there's a dichotomy between the personalities, whether it's Wally West versus Barry Allen or Dick Grayson versus Bruce Wayne or whatever. I like that. Just don't let Dan Didio anywhere near Sam Wilson.
And then you also have to look at it from an overall kind of business strategy standpoint. Like Kevin Feige has said, one of the focuses for the MCU post Endgame is going to be an increased diversity in the lineup of the core lineup. So, you know, Anthony Mackie kind of helps in that regard. It makes a lot of sense from not just a storytelling standpoint, but from a, you know, economic standpoint as well.
And from a thematic standpoint, the idea of like passing the shield on the same way you might be passing America on.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm trying to think of any other characters that we haven't touched. Gosh, there's so much in this movie to dissect. But I think we've pretty well hit the major points to this point. I'll just open up the floor. Any other things about this movie that you guys haven't touched on that you wanted to bring a mention to, whether it's a character moment, a scene, an actor, anything of that nature?
I've got
Hulka,
two.
Hulka, burning fudge.
There you go.
I want Ben and Jerry's to actually come out with that. We saw that it exists because Hulk was eating it.
I have two that are kind of just comments more than anything else. So the time travel bit where they're revisiting past films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, of all the films to revisit, Thor the Dark World gets busted out. Yep. So, you know, I mentioned this to Greg earlier, you know, on the phone this week, but like, they could have easily gone to nowhere because the Power Stone and the Ether were both on nowhere at one point and just done a big Guardians revisiting. But I'm not going to complain because it got us to see Asgard one more time in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which was awesome. And also during that closing action sequence, when they're kind of playing cosmic football with the Infinity Gauntlet,
with
the Iron Gauntlet, I guess you could call it. And Peter has been blasted into oblivion and is just laying there shell-shocked, and Captain Marvel shows up. It's like, got something for me, Peter Parker? And like the horn dog 15-year-old look on his face with his mouth open just being in awe of this woman is like everything I want from male characters interacting with Captain Marvel going forward, essentially.
Speaking of Peter Parker, I do want to pull out my own little fan theory for Far From Home. So I made the comment that on Peter's next birthday, he can go to a bar because he'll technically be 21. So what I think is going to happen is that there's a huge rush of teenagers going and doing that, and then they pass some laws real quickly saying that, oh, well, if you're confirmed snapped, then you can't do this. So that's why they go on the trip to Europe, because then you can get it, and then you can drink it at 15.
I like it.
That's funny. I like it.
I wanted to mention Loki because I guess alternate timeline Loki exists now.
Yes, and I'm assuming will be
with
used
the Tesseract
for the Disney Plus television series that's coming.
Well, I think that's beautiful and wonderful.
The more Tom Hiddleston, the better.
Yep.
I will say that I appreciated how Star-Lord's big moment in this film was getting kneed in the nuts by the woman he loved so very much that her death caused him to single-handedly doom the entire universe. So
Not just one knee, but two knees to the nuts. The first of which missed, the second of which hit both.
Yep. Hit both knees, yeah, hit both nuts, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Also,
as Guardians of the Galaxy.
I was about to say, we talked about Tony's ending, we talked about Cap's ending, we didn't really talk about Thor's ending, where
with his,
he essentially walks away from his leadership role in New Asgard and is going off with the Guardians to see, you know, just to kind of, as he puts it, it's the first time in over 1,000 years his path hasn't been defined for him, so he's just going to kind of go see what's out there, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he leaves New Asgard in the capable hands of Valkyrie. Yep. Tessa Thompson's character, and she has more than proven herself worthy of that position, probably more so than Thor at this point. And Thor is going out to find himself throughout the universe, which could introduce us, potentially, Thor with the Guardians to Beta Ray Bill. I think a lot of us are expecting that, even, perhaps in Guardians 3. Yes. And I adore the dynamic between Thor and the Guardians, particularly Thor and Star-Lord's relationship is amazing. Star-Lord trying to assert command over his ship, and just – I was going to make this point earlier in the movie. Chris Hemsworth is one of the best comedic actors of his generation, 100%. I've seen this dude in enough comedies at this point and enough comedic roles. He has a sense of timing that I would expect from, like, a veteran comedian. Mm-hmm. He is so good at this, but the look on his face at the end of this movie when they're debating who's going to be the leader, and he says, "We all know who the leader is," and then Star-Lord goes, you do mean me, right?" And he's like, "Of course I do." And just the look that he gives him is just – it reminded me of like heel Stone Cold to a degree. like the kind of like the I'm going to murder you eyes, but with the sincerity over top of it. Just it's going to be great. It's going to be hilarious. His dynamic with the Guardians all respect him so much more than they do their own leader, even though they like their leader as their friend. But they
see,
yeah, just so good.
I'm not entirely convinced that they're actually going to do it. Don't get me wrong. I want them to, but I think there's at least a possibility they just pop up in Guardians 3 and say, "Oh, we dropped Thor off somewhere at some point. Yeah. So he could go do something."
Waste, in my opinion.
I agree, because I am much more excited for Thor in a Guardians movie directed by James Gunn than I am Thor in a Ragnarok sequel directed by Taika Waititi, because James Gunn, especially in Guardians 2, at least allows you to have some emotional moments in his films.
Right.
Unlike what we got
for as Ragnarok. Goofy as they are, he does let those emotional beats actually breathe.
Yes. And so that actually is much more exciting to me than a Taika-led Thor sequel.
But Thor gets his ending moment. Iron Man gets his, Cap gets his, all in different directions. Hulk still out there as Professor Hulk. Nat's dead. Clint finally is reunited with his family and ready to presumably enter into his Disney Plus series, where he'll pass the mantle on to Kate Bishop. And so with
Scott's
all that,
back, Scott's with Hope and his daughter.
Yep, his daughter. Oh, that's another. God, I feel like this podcast is going to never end, Nick, because there keep more items come up. So
again, another example of like, you don't have to do much with dads and daughters to emotionally break me, but like that moment when Scott knocks on the door and they kind of shoot it in a way that you think it might be Judy Greer, who played his ex-wife in the Ant-Man movies, coming to the door. And then as she walks forward, you kind of realize what's going on. And like, I don't even know the actress's name, but both Paul Rudd and that actress sold that scene to like, that was another moment that got me wet around the eyes. So it, you know, it's just, this movie is just filled with those moments for me.
And the one thing about it, and I totally agree, it's an amazing scene. It's going to be great going forward. And I know why they chose this narrative path, because she is a character in the comics that has a heroic future. But at the same time, part of me does think it's a shame to lose the little girl. We're probably not going to see her anymore, that played his daughter in the first two Ant-Man movies, because she was so good. Like, I loved
their chemistry was amazing.
Their chemistry was amazing. And I actually thought of that after the movie. I was like, God, that's the only, I'm sure it's going to be good. I'm sure it's going to be great. But like, I hate losing her from the MCU, because I wish there was a universe where we could just wait for her to grow up and grow into this kind of heroic role. Because she had such a dynamic chemistry with Paul. But with all that said, before we wrap up, I want to kind of go around the room and ask a couple of off the cuff lightning round questions for the panel here. To start things off, favorite scene in the movie. And I'm going to start with you, Jenny.
Oh, Jesus.
What I meant by that is I can start with someone else if you'd like.
No, I don't know what you mean by favorite, because.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think we could all say the closing battle sequence.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I was about to say. Is that one off the table?
Yeah. Because, I mean.
Favorite moment. How about that?
Okay. The reveal of Fat Thor was just fucking delightful. I wasn't expecting it, and it was just amazing. Wonderful.
I'll go with the returns, like the from from the crackle, pretty much the kind of little 45 seconds from the first time we hear the crackle of static in Captain America's communicator in his earpiece through Spider-Man swinging onto the screen, where we get those big triumphant returns. That's my favorite moment in the movie.
Tim?
Cap lifting Mjolnir and pushing Thanos' shit in.
That was mine, too. Sam?
So mine is on your left or Cap lifting Mjolnir.
Yeah. Okay. Biggest tear-jerking moment. And I'll start with you this time, Nick.
Oh, God. It's either Rhodey, Peter, and Pepper at Tony's side as he actually dies, as we mentioned earlier, fucking Happy and the kid and those damn cheeseburgers. Which sounds so stupid out of context, doesn't it? But I feel like, you know, and Tim, I think you can kind of understand this, and Sam, I think you
I do
the same thing as well, but like, for people who recently have been back and kind of binge-watched everything over the last, like, month, of all the things to pull out and call back to, God, it was effective.
Tim?
Are we talking tearjerker because you're sad or happy?
Either or.
Then I will say final shot of the movie. Boom. The dance.
Yep, that's a good one.
The dance.
Sam?
When Peter takes his mask off and starts explaining where he's been to Tony, and then Tony just stops him and hugs him.
Oh,
wow,
that's a good one. Shut up.
That's a good one.
You suck. I hate you for that.
Peter and Tony, like, it was a very short-lived thing in the comics in terms of their very close relationship, but the movies have taken that, and, like, it's the best thing at this point. Like, I could have done for it. I understand the narrative reasons why Tony had to go and everything, but I could have done for years of Tony Stark as Peter's surrogate father. It is it's remarkable how well that works.
Speaking as not a big Spider-Man fan, I agree completely. Jenny, your pick.
That would be the selfless and beautiful death of my beloved Tony.
Yeah, same. I would almost put a tie with that and the last shot of Cap for totally different reasons, but the Tony one wins out for me due to my attachment to RDJ. But now, with the last question, before we'll pitch to shilling our products and all that, MVP of the movie. It has to be an actor that you name. And let's start with you, Sam.
Oh, geez. Put me on the spot here. I'm going to say Chris Evans.
Tim?
Actor. Not so much character, but actor. So I'm going to say RDJ, as a matter of fact, because, I mean, he's at the point now where he's got that fuck money. He could kind of be shoving that in our faces and doing the kind of I told you so victory lap and sleepwalk through the end of this series, and he did anything but. I mean, this was the pinnacle of his performance. I mean,
he pulled a Hugh Jackman and went out on top.
Yeah, big time, big time.
Nick,
I think Tim is technically right, but like, I'm gonna have to say Chris Evans as well. Like,
man,
and that comes from someone who
it's
like,
hard for me not to say Chris Evans. Believe me,
the two Captain America sequels to this point have been, in my opinion, the best movies in the MCU. So like, it's not like he hasn't done good work before, but this shows us a Cap who has lost, and that is something he's never really done before. And it is different enough from the Captain America that we've seen previously while still maintaining the essence of the character that it's pretty remarkable what we see from Chris Evans after the 5-year time jump.
Jenny?
It's Robert Downey Jr. And I'll give an honorable mention to Karen Gillan for Nebula.
Mm. Yeah. I'm going with Robert Downey Jr. as well. I think this was, he's never given a weak performance in the MCU, but to me, this was his crowning achievement. It was a masterclass from him, and so many people were outstanding in this movie, but he stood out particularly to me. Well, with that being said, Jenny, how can the folks find you on Twitter, and what do you have coming our way on the podcast feed?
On Twitter, I am Jenny Cruz 2814. On the feed today, we had a new episode of Talking WCW.
Yeah.
On the wrestling feed, and then there's a recent episode of Geek and Sassy in which me and Miranda talked about Doom Patrol Volume 1. Comic books, finally, in a post-comic book world, and that is on the pop feed. And then I will have a new Freak Out Drive-In probably next week.
Awesome. Tim?
Oh, shit, I don't know. You can find me on Twitter at Cyke68. I guess I'll start talking about Avengers Endgame now. Well, once this podcast goes up. And I'll start tweeting about it because I've tried to remain mum, save my thoughts for this show. Beyond that, you can find me on the aforementioned Talking WCW on the Place B Nation wrestling feed with Jenny, with you, Greg. And I've done a bunch of other shows recently on Place B Nation. Bup! I think most recently...
Looking forward, looking back.
Yes, looking forward, looking back. Thank you for the save with with you, Jenny, with Andy Atherton, with your cohort, Miranda, with Scott Criscolo. Was that everybody?
Russell
Sellers.
Russell Sellers was on that as well. That's right. Who I was sad and could not be with us here tonight, but that's okay. But yeah, more stuff to come in the near future, no doubt.
And Sam, how can folks find you on social media, and what do you have coming up on 90 to Nothing?
So I am on Twitter as Mr. Woodles. That's really the only one you want to follow, and it's not even that interesting. It's jokes and political retweets. Instagram, I'm also Mr. Woodles, but it's just food and my pets. And I do have a podcast here on Place to Be Nation Pop. It is called 90 to Nothing. I am one half of it, specifically the nothing half. Russell Sellers and I discuss 90s movies, the good, the bad, and the ugly, which is not a 90s movie. But upcoming, we will, in honor of Star Wars Day, which as of this recording is coming up in just a few days, we'll be doing the only Star Wars movie released in the 90s, and that is The Phantom Menace. So stay tuned for that.
Jesus.
It's not that bad.
It's all right.
You know,
sorry, I want to read these comments about Avengers Endgame. I'm glad you guys mentioned that. I just got this note from Andrew Chandler Fraser Garner, our good friend, who saw the movie with us this weekend. His summary of Endgame, it's all right.
And I was sitting next to him at Captain Marvel, and that was his summary of that one as well.
Wow. Also every other movie he said. Yes.
I was sitting next to him at Highlander 2, The Quickening.
Said that was all right. I mean, that was his reaction to Suicide Squad as well. That's all right.
I thought
it was more of a, it was more of a reserved, it's all right.
Now, which film
he's
did
like
he...
Iron Groot.
Yeah. He's just... What if he had leaned over and said, this is the best fucking movie I've ever seen?
Hey, God, that would be... That would be a 12-star in the Tokyo Dome type rating.
I think one time he was excited about a movie, and like he texted me, goes, you know I don't say this too often, so I just want you to know how serious I am, but fuck yeah, I'm excited.
Love it.
Yes. Yes. Well, with all that being said, thank you guys so much for joining us to share in this group therapy session about this movie, this experience that we all went through. And we're going to take a break right now. Believe it or not, there's more show to come.
Maybe. We'll see. We might make an off-air audible on that. We'll talk about it. This may or may not be the end of the podcast. Don't hold us to this.
Yeah. Anyway, see you later.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pops!
feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceMination.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceMination.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceMination.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.